Okay, good morning, everyone. Today is October 23rd, and this is the City of Miami Beach's Finance and Economic Resiliency Committee meeting. I'm joined by my colleagues, Commissioner Richardson, Commissioner Mark Samulin, and Commissioner Minor. We've got not a tremendously robust agenda today, so hopefully we can get through it in about 2 hours. That's my goal. Some housekeeping items. Items 2 and 8 have been withdrawn, and item 10 has been deferred. Are there any other items that have been withdrawn or deferred?
Mr. Chair, item 2 is mine. Is not withdrawn. It's deferred. I'm sorry if the message
sorry.
Got
Okay.
confused.
Okay, deferred. Okay.
And then,
John Woodruff, anything
just
else?
Real quick. Yeah, I just want to point out that we added an item yesterday evening. It was the Shane Center lease. It's number 31. It was a late add. So it was in the supplemental information that was sent out last evening. I can re-forward that to everyone if that helps.
I have my copy of item 31. I have not been asked to take anything out of order, but I'm happy to do that. Just let me know. Otherwise, we'll start with item number 1. And Commissioner Samulin, this is your item regarding bus rapid transit over the Julia Tuttle.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll be very brief because I think we have folks here to make a presentation. This is an exciting opportunity to connect the Bay and the mainland. The city is a vested partner. I think we've got some good progress, and this is a standing quarterly item. I don't believe we're asked to take action, but it's really a brief update, any issues, and keeping the ball and keeping the bus moving. With that, I'll turn it over to Jose.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Mayor. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jose Gonzalez, Transportation and Mobility Director. Thank you for this opportunity to provide an update on the Julia Tuttle Express Bus Service. As you all know, we've been working with Miami-Dade County for some time now to do essentially two things, to try to start up a permanent service using the inside shoulders of the Julia Tuttle Causeway by 2023. That's more the long-term plan. And but in the interim, and potentially as early as early next year, start up some type of demonstration service using the outside shoulders of the Julia Tuttle Causeway. And the other thing I wanted to mention is that we provided an update to the 41st Street Committee. This summer, it was, I think it was July, and they passed a motion endorsing the Julia Tuttle Express service, which is intended to also operate along 41st Street and then proceed east to serve major hotels such as, the Fountain Blue, and then work its way down to the city center area, convention center area. So with that, we have members from Miami-Dade County that should be on the call, and they have a brief presentation and an update on their efforts, their study. Francesca, are you on?
There's someone going to speak?
Yes, yes, they should be on. Let's see if either Francesca or Gia from Miami-Dade County Transportation.
Hi, can everyone hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you all for having us with you this morning. Thanks, Jose, for that intro. So yes, we're coming to you all just to present a update on the plans for the Bus Express Rapid Transit high level. The BERT system is part of the Smart Plan network. It includes 9 rapid transit routes, one of which is being implemented by FDOT. And then there are 3 that will actually travel to Miami Beach. And one in particular that will use the Julia Tuttle Causeway to help maintain travel time reliability. And so that one is our Route F1, And as Jose mentioned, we are working on interim service. Route F1 is scheduled to begin in 2023, and we're also working on interim service to expedite that service into 2021. So we have a presentation. I believe my colleagues, Peter Halliburton, might be out there as well and may need to be unmuted if he is. And if not, I'll just start sharing my screen. All right, can everyone see the presentation?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Okay, good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Excellent. Thanks. Okay, thanks for that intro, Francesca. So the maps on this slide show the smart plan network on the left, the six primary corridors in different colors, which I think are familiar to most of you. And on the right, the BERT network routes. So we're going to touch on the whole network initially and then focus in on those three routes Francesca mentioned serve Miami Beach. Next slide, please. So the objective of the BERT network is to provide higher speed, uninterrupted travel using existing expressways and particularly express lanes on the expressways, such as on I-95, to ensure reliable high-speed, longer-distance travel. The BERT network extends the reach of the smart corridors, and the table below here shows those eight routes Francesca mentioned and highlighted at the bottom are the three routes serving Miami Beach, conveniently sort of named north, central, and south routes with the start and end points indicated there. Next slide, please. Okay. So this chart shows the 10 subtasks involved in the BERT implementation analysis that's currently ongoing. The check marks is all of those tasks that have been completed, the arrows indicating the ongoing efforts. And so, as you can see, we've sort of called out the BERT Beach Express North Route F1 first, and that is, as the commissioner mentioned, proceeding ahead of schedule of the other routes. Next slide, please. The BERT implementation analysis included market analysis, which evaluated demographics and commute patterns across the county to estimate the transit propensity for each of these eight routes. And you can see in the table, we've segmented those into sort of three tiers with the highest, moderate, and lower transit propensity. And as I think we all would expect, two of those beach routes, particularly the north and south, are in that group of the highest transit propensity. And that really relates to the density of population and employment and also travel, as you can see by congestion within that area. Next slide, please. This chart shows the service frequency and also the ridership estimates for each of those routes. So you can see that sort of across the board, we've got a plan or program of peak period frequencies of 10 minutes for the highest frequency routes, 15 and 20 minutes. Slightly less frequent service during the off-peak hours. And also notable is that those two highest propensity beach routes, F1 and F3, also include weekend service, which, you know, we'd expect with all of the jobs and all of the travel on the weekends. And the final column shows the estimates based on our 2015 stocks model, which was the adopted model currently being sort of worked on for an update by the TPO, but we don't expect those numbers to change very significantly. The Beach Express North, as you can see, has got a high ridership potential of 8,000 trips a day, which would make it one of the busiest routes in the system today. Next slide, please. The express nature of these routes, once you get off the expressways and onto interrupted arterial facilities, will rely on transit signal priority to minimize delay. And that concept involves the bus communicating with the signal that it is approaching. The signal controller recognizes and estimates the time of the bus and extends the green if it's in a green phase for the bus, or if it's in a red phase for the bus, it'll truncate the other phase to return a green phase to the bus as soon as possible to keep things moving. Next slide, please. This is a chart of the locations for those transit signal priority applications. In each case, the early green or green extension, as I indicated. And so for the Beach Express North route, you can see there are three locations. If we go to the next slide, that maps the three locations on the beach, Alton and 41st and Indian Creek, and Collins and 17th, where the bus will be, recognized and sped through those intersections to minimize delay and improve travel reliability. So this slide then focuses in on the work currently ongoing, as Francesca mentioned, and Jose, to implement an interim service as quickly as possible, hopefully early 2021. So the county has been coordinating over the past several months with the City of Miami Beach and Miami, also with FDOT and Federal Highway Administration, to get all the I's dotted and T's crossed for this implementation. So there are a number of contingent items. The first one there is confirmation of the route and the stops for interim service. Those discussions have been ongoing with the city and I think are close to finalization. That'll allow us to sort of finalize our service plan and ridership estimates. The concept of operations that specifies exactly how the buses will work on those shoulders that Jose mentioned. Initially, in the short term, as of next year, that would be on the outside shoulder. Longer term, FDOT's building the inside shoulder to be a longer term facility. And the concept of operations is done complete, just awaiting the finalization of route details I mentioned. So we're close to go on that. The work to actually prepare the outside shoulder for safe operations is ongoing with FDOT, includes leveling out some of the drainage depressions, as it were, so the bus doesn't sort of seahorse along in the shoulder. A significant effort is to conduct research with cyclists who are currently allowed to use those outside shoulder. They will be displaced. They won't be allowed to use the shoulder while this pilot on the outside shoulder is ongoing. DTPW will provide buses. We're expecting new technology buses that, possibly electric, certainly hybrid or compressed natural gas, that minimize noise and provide an optimal service for riders. The funding for operation and maintenance costs, the agreement between the funding partners is still ongoing, pending a couple of small details. So as already mentioned, service is anticipated to begin early next year, or if any of these above items may delay that slightly. And as I mentioned, the ridership forecast is a very robust 8,000 a day, given those high service levels we talked about. So that concludes my presentation. The next slide shows contact information for our project manager, Francesca, and also public involvement officer, Yvette Holt. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Colleagues, comments, questions? Okay, Commissioner Samlin, your hand is up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Francesca and team, for that very informative presentation. I guess I just have a couple things that I want to touch on. First, to our city staff, Jose, I know we had set aside some funding, and I know this was an update. Do you need anything from us at this point to keep this ball and bus moving?
Commissioner, this was more of an update because it has been a while since we've presented this project to this committee. So at this time, we really don't need any policy direction, if you will. We continue working with Miami-Dade County. The plan is essentially the same, since the onset of this effort. The route is still the same, starting from Golden Glades, serving Mount Sinai, Fountain Blue, and then the city center area. With regard to the funding, I think we still need to have those more in-depth discussions with Miami-Dade County. But in terms of the plan, it's essentially what you all have seen before. We continue to work with the county. We're very excited about the possibility of starting interim service early next year. I know there are a lot of people that want that to happen, and that's sort of the approach of crawling before we walk. So I think that's a good approach, and continue working on that long term to try to, you know, bring it in as much as possible. Right now it's 2023, as Peter mentioned, but, you know, we're trying to expedite that at all possible.
Yeah, thank you for that, Jose. And add my name, please, to the list of people who are excited about the interim service. I think it's really important that we get that rolling as quickly as possible. You know, we've talked about mass transit and connections between the beach and the mainland for so long, but here we have the real thing. And we actually are going to be operating. So early 2021 sounds like January in my books. And I say that a little bit tongue in cheek. But when I hear early, I think that, you know, January 2nd or something. But we really, really want to push, because I think this will be a positive message for other programs. Let me just, my final thought regards what I would consider a key success factor for this Express North, and that is ridership. And I'm very excited to hear about that 8,000 number. That sounds, you know, like a very strong number. And now we need to deliver and exceed it. And to me, I think there's a couple things that are inherent in that. It's first, communications. We need to make sure that we're going to get the word out. And I'm sure the county has some ideas and programs. And I don't expect that we'll explore that today. But I just want to underline communications. And Jose, maybe working with Tanya Daniels and our team, we can really start to rev up the engines for communications. And importantly, I think specialized outreach and communications to some of the hotels in Miami Beach. I think one of the critical groups here is our workforce coming from the north that probably today has to rely on cars to get back and forth. Now we're giving them a wonderful solution. And frankly, we've done a lot for our hotels. And, you know, there have been a lot of discussions this body's had around parking and things that we can do to help our hotels. Well, now we're helping them in this way. You know, maybe there's some employee programs they can put in place. Maybe they can provide some communications. I think we should be in touch with the hotel union as well. But now is that time to ramp up the communications engine. And congratulations on the great work. I can't wait. Maybe the next meeting we can actually do on the bus. So with that, Mr. Mm-hmm. Chair, those are all my thoughts.
Thank you, Commissioner Samuel, and thanks for staying on top of this. Great update by everybody. It's exciting. We're, you know, hopefully just a few months away from starting the service. So hopefully good news ahead. Item number three. Hello, who's that? Francesca?
Yes, sorry. Just one clarification. Commissioner Samulin mentioned that he anticipated that service in early 2021 might mean January. Just want to say that FDOT's updates to the outside shoulder will likely begin letting in January 2021, and then it'll take an extra 100 to 120 days for construction. So just giving you that that guidepost.
So then we're thinking summertime.
No. We're definitely thinking the first or second quarter. I guess it is summertime for the beginning of summer.
Okay. It's government. Nothing happens fast, but summertime it is.
Chair, can I ask a question? I'm sorry.
Yeah, of course. I'm sorry. Of course. I didn't see your hand.
I just put my hand up. I'm sorry.
That's fine. Absolutely. I'm informal. Cool.
I may be confused about the timing, but I'm thinking that this shoulder rapid lane was something that Commissioner Sally Hayman and I, when I was a state representative, met with the secretary, FDOT secretary, in I think March of 2018. And so it's kind of, the timing is kind of prompting me to ask what has taken so long, because I remember Commissioner Hayman and I having that meeting when I was in Tallahassee. So that was, I think that would be 2.5 years ago. Is that right? So I'm curious what's taken so long. Did FDOT not give us the green light fast enough? Because I thought, I remember in the meeting, he said he was going to look at it. And I think it was a week later, he said, yes, I'm going to approve this. So what's taking so long?
That's a great question, Commissioner Richardson. So honestly, that timetable kind of predates my involvement with the project. And I can't speak to the history as much as I would like to. What I can say is that in working with FDOT, having to create a standard of the concept of operations, the rule book by which we'll conduct this operation has, you know, taken some time to fine tune exactly what needs to be in that playbook. So I don't know if that framework was really developed in 2018. We've been working with FDOT to kind of call that out this year. So I can, you know, speak to the fact that it has taken us a while to understand what all needs to be explained and studied, and then go ahead and facilitate that so that we could get the approval from FDOT.
Okay, well, we're looking forward to seeing the bus run. Thank you, and thanks, Commissioner Samulin, for staying on top of this.
Thank you.
No further hands. Let's move on to item number three, which is both Commissioner Richardson and Commissioner Bengora co-sponsored this item. This is about providing some, I guess, rent relief, mortgage relief assistance programs.
You want me to kick it off?
Up to you. Do you want to kick it off, or is someone going to some staff?
Well, I think I'll kick it off. I think this was an item that first came to us with an authorization, I think, of maybe close to $700,000. And then this committee, we decided that we were going to authorize 330 of that seven. And so there's Maria. Hey, Maria, how are you?
I'm good, sir. How are you this morning?
Good. With the chair's indulgence, why don't you tell us what's going on?
Thank you, sir. And actually, we obviously have some good news as well. And there's an LFC that'll be coming out hopefully today. We just received an additional $33,000 in a competitive grant that we submitted to the Emergency Food and Shelter Program. And we'll be coming to commission next Wednesday for an additional $1.5 million in CARES funding that could potentially be used for rent assistance as well. And just to give you a bit of a status update, and actually forgive me, there's an additional $149,000 that the state is allocating to us that will be coming to you as well. But aside from those new monies that are coming to us, we have expended $652,000 serving 264 households, and we still have $218,000 on the books right now to assist people. This is separate from the $330,000 that you have committed from general fund. In our general fund, I just asked our contractor, which is Hope in Miami-Dade, last night to give me an update as they are, their report still is not due. They have assisted 17 households and have spent $57,300. So right now we're moving at a steady clip. However, the bulk of the money that we have in tranches 2 and 4 must be spent by December 30th. So we're under the gun to make sure that we spend all of that money before December 30th. We will be coming to you with on our item next week to ask if we could have an ongoing lottery registration process on the city's website so that we can have a constant flow of applicants so that we can process as many people as we can in time to expend the money by December 30th. As it stands right now, in addition to the $218,000 that's remaining, the $149,000 from the state will also have that December 30th deadline. So that's just about $360,000 that we have to spend between now and December 30th. And that's quite a challenge. Number one, because people are going back to work. So the need has definitely gone down. And the bigger challenge is that of those households that we are serving directly with these monies, the great many of them are not qualifying because they don't have legal status. And that's been the single biggest impediment. Interestingly enough, what we are doing with the tranche 3, which is the general fund monies, those are primarily those people that don't get served in the other categories. And they're moving along at a pretty decent clip. They just started in the last month. They've already spent $57,000. So they're going at a pretty decent pace. So I would recommend that given the fact that we have a new infusion of money with a very specific and tight deadline to expend by December, that we perhaps hold off on new monies until we spend these monies, and then I can give you a much better picture. I'm a little concerned about our food program because we're seeing that people are going back to work. They're still coming in for food assistance. And at some point, I think we might have to decide, you know, who are we really going to serve with that resource? But I would recommend and advise that you allow us to stay the course at least until we expend the current monies, put all of our efforts in spending the deadline-specific funds, and then we can explore in January if there's an additional need. After also the economy is starting to perk up again, we can have a better analysis of how many of our people are actually employed or underemployed when they're seeking assistance.
Can I follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, please. Mike is yours.
Thank you, sir. So, Maria, remind us how much the 330, I think, was part of the third tranche of money that we allocated. How much money do you remember how much money we allocated in tranche 1 and 2 for rental assistance?
Let's see. Combined with all of our tranches 1, 2, and 4, we have $870,000.
Is that what we've already expended, or does that include the?
That's the allocation. The allocation expended is $652,545.
We spent in 1, 2, and I didn't realize.
And 4.
We had a tranche 4. I didn't realize. So I thought tranche three was the 330 that we authorized.
Correct. Correct.
How much was in 4? I don't remember that.
4 is the $247,000 that we received from the state that we're now going to be receiving an extra $149,000.
Okay, great. Yeah. All right. So to date, we've helped Miami Beach families to the tune of $652,545. And you have approximately $360,000 that remains to be, and you have to spend that by December 30th, right?
That is correct. The check last check must be cut by December 30th.
Is any of the 330 left? Is any of tranche 3? How much is that?
Yes, we've spent 57,300, so that leaves you 270,000 remaining. 272,700.
And so that 270 is part of the 360 or no?
No, that's separate. That
yeah,
money
because
doesn't
it doesn't
have a deadline.
It doesn't have a deadline, right?
Exactly.
Okay. And just, I want to make sure I have it. the tranche three, we made that eligible for anyone living. So that's where you're helping families that wouldn't qualify in other programs, right?
Correct. And we structured it to make sure that the documentation would be sufficient, that if the opportunity presented for FEMA or another federal agency to reimburse us, we've got the documentation to allow so.
Okay. And are you seeing a slowdown with requests right now on the housing? Because I know the food, you know, we've been watching the numbers there, but on the housing, is there still a supply of people coming in or?
Well, as a reminder, our last lottery, we're just finishing up. So we've been processing through a lottery format in order to serve. By switching over to an ongoing indefinite process, we'll have a better feel for what the real need is, because we haven't asked anyone since the last lottery, which was back in August. So we'll have a better understanding once we open it up and see how many people come in on the new process. And the other advantage to this is that we can identify which slot of funds the person is best qualified for. So it doesn't slow down them getting service, but it does prioritize us in being able to channel the money to the funds that need to be spent first.
So if this one bucket of money has to be spent by the end of the year, basically. And I'm wondering are we going to be able to identify everybody? Are we going to be able to spend that? Is there anything that we should be doing on the administration side to sort of accelerate our assistance to people?
I think the big issue has been that because we've used a lottery format and we have to open and close, once we open it up and keep it as an ongoing registration, I think that that's going to change because we get calls on a daily basis. So this is going to enable us to now say, instead of saying wait until we open another lottery, go ahead and go online and we can start processing you right away. So I think that that in and of itself is going to have a huge impact. By the way, that was a recommendation that was provided to us by the state when we spoke to them this week, that they've seen other jurisdictions that have had the same issue. And they're also arguing that point of forget about lotteries, just go ahead and start accepting people as they come so that you can draw down the funds in a timely manner.
Okay. And remember, I think we did it that way when we started.
That's correct.
But the problem we had, if I recall, is that we had people that felt like they were in line, but somehow they didn't get in the door fast enough. And that's why we went to the lottery. But you think we have enough money to serve the people in line and we won't have that problem occur again, right?
We definitely have enough money to get us through December at the current pace of expenditure. So opportunity to open an online registration process would do is hopefully capture some of those people who are HOA fees and maintenance fees behind, that those are the people that tend not to go into entitlement programs. And hopefully we'll be able to capture them because now they're getting their quarterly assessments. So we'll probably see an uptick in homeowners who are applying for assistance.
Okay. And I remember the commission initially took action on how we were going to do the process, lottery versus first come, first serve. So my question is, when will you start this new process? And do you need any action from the commission? Do you need us to make a recommendation that we go back and then go back to the first come, first serve for these reasons and send that to the commission?
And actually, the state qualifies at first come, first qualified.
Yeah.
So that the truth is that is if you get your documents done and you come to us, you're good to go. We're coming to commission on Wednesday. Part of our action in accepting the $1.5 million will also be the action to open up an ongoing registration process. That's a joint action on Wednesday's item.
And do you need anything from this committee or?
It would be great to recommend keeping an open registration process at least through the year so that we can timely expend these funds. We can reevaluate January 1 if we want to change that process, but just to ensure that there's enough applicants to meet this, to open that up. And I will say this, the biggest challenge when we're expending these federal monies, which the state is a federal allocation through the state, it's the level of documentation that's required. And I know people get very upset and angry that we're asking for this, but the reality is this is what the federal government is asking of us in order to do proper income certifications. So if we do that that online registration process, we can be a little quicker in telling people, hey, you missed one of your bank statements. We could process that request a little faster because it's ongoing to a lot of people at the same time, as opposed to taking 20 people at a time. We can do a lot more simultaneously and hopefully get through the number of people applying quicker.
Okay. And if the commission takes the action that you're recommending next Wednesday, how soon can we open up this new process, the first come, first qualified?
Thursday.
Okay.
The very next day. We've already worked with IT to prep it so that we can up and run the very next day. And we'll work with communications to ensure that they put it in the e-blast in our social media and announce it on the COVID resource list.
Okay. Well, I certainly would like to hear from my colleagues, but you've made your case to me. So I'll certainly support. I'll make a motion that we accept the administration's recommendation on changing the first come, first qualified through the end of the year, through December 31st, so we can get this money spent. I would hate that the federal government or the state is allocating money to us and we wouldn't be able to process it fast enough. So I think it's a great idea and appreciate all the hard work you guys are doing, Maria. Thank you.
Yeah, I appreciate
yes,
the
you.
Hard
work.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just was going to say I appreciate all the hard work and will second the motion.
Yeah. Commissioner Minor, are you still with us? Yeah, he's there. Okay. Do you have anything to add? If not, we'll move this. Okay. Commissioner Richardson, Maria, thank you for your hard work.
Thank you, sir.
It's going to provide great relief to our residents. And yeah, I think speed is important, you know, as we approach month 8 of this. Okay. We'll move on to item number 4, which is an update on the city's Blue Ways Master Plan. This is an item that I've been working on for well over a year, going on 2 years. Is Betsy Wheaton going to tee this up? I'm not sure who's got this.
Yes.
Hi, Betsy, you're on mute. Okay.
Okay, perfect. Good morning. My name is Elizabeth Wheaton, Environment and Sustainability Director. I'm here to give an update on the Blue Ways Master Plan. In 2014, the Blue Ways Master Plan identified Maurice Gibb Park as a potential location for a mooring field. In June of 2019, the direction from the City Commission was to conduct a study to understand the financial and permitting viability of a mooring field. This past May 2020, we presented the mooring field study to the Finance Committee and were given direction to explore grant options for the design and permitting of such facility. I want to note that the preliminary study identified a 50-slip mooring specifically adjacent to Maurice Gibb Park. However, the study also looked at future phases that would extend further south along West Avenue. For funding, we've identified the Florida Inland Navigation District funding, which would provide a 50-50 match specific for design and permitting, as well as when we get to construction, another 50%. Other funding that has been identified is boating infrastructure grants, the Florida Boating Improvement Program, the Clean Vessel Act. However, these grant opportunities are specific to construction, and we wouldn't be able to access those until we had design plans and permits in hand. So this item is I do want to note that one of the questions that we received from Commissioner Samulin and other members of the public is what happens once the mooring field is created and where do the boats that are currently located in those areas go? So the reason that a mooring field is being proposed and was suggested as part of the Blue Ways Master Plan is because currently boaters can boat anywhere in Miami Beach waters that are not considered a channel. So the boaters have the ability and the freedom to anchor and moor wherever they would like. However, if a mooring field is created within those boundaries, the boaters would have to register for a mooring ball and pay the fee, and they'd have to moor at that ball, and it would be the city would have the ability to keep out boats that did not register to be a part of that mooring field. The city of Miami is in the process right now of creating two mooring fields, one at Watson Island, which will have 100 slips, and one at Virginia Key, which will have 45 slips. Watson Island is scheduled to come online in quarter four of 2021. With the Watson Island mooring field, it is expected that we're going to see a lot of boats coming over into our waters from that area. One of the items that was included in the mooring field study was an evaluation of number of boats that have increased over time. And there has been an increase from the early 2000s in just the number of boats that are now mooring off of Maurice Gibb Park, as well as further south along West Avenue. So, you know, questions, I think, also for this committee, now that this item is being heard, is would you like to extend the boundaries of the feasibility study further south along West Avenue, or would you like to keep the budget request for next year, the 50 slips adjacent specifically to Maurice Gibb Park?
Betsy, the reason you bring that up is, as I understand it, WAVNA has expressed interest and actually urgency to have us extend the mooring field down to Fifth Street. Is that correct?
That's correct. As part of the public outreach for the initial study, we had met with Sunset Harbor neighborhood as well as West Avenue. And the West Avenue neighborhood has been very vocal and in expressing the want for a mooring field adjacent to their neighborhood. I want to also note that there's a meeting scheduled for October 28th with Commissioner Eileen Higgins on this topic that WAVNA has organized.
Colleagues, this is my item, and I can tell you how I feel about it. Do you have any comments or thoughts? Commissioner Samuelin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your leadership on this. This is a very important item. We have a real problem, and moorings are a tried and true approach. So I like directionally where we're going. Let me just touch on a few different points. First, on the West Avenue extension, I'm not sure if you want us to try and land on that specifically today, but conceptually, I'm open to that. I'd like to know the pros and cons. I'd like to see the cost, but I have raised the point of unintended consequences. So if the thought is that, you know, if we do this in Sunset Harbor, the problem may move south, and that is the recommendation, you know, I'm absolutely open to that. The second thing I want to bring up, Betsy, I understood that some of the grants could be pursued actually before the city has major out-of-pocket expenses. Is that correct?
Sorry, I was on mute. Yes, that's correct. So the Florida Inland Navigation District funding will be open for application this upcoming March. And so the intent would be to include the mooring field permitting and design as part of the fiscal year 21-22 budget process. As that's moving forward through the budgeting process, we would be applying for the find funds. So if we were to receive that grant, they would become available in October of 2021.
Okay. So I don't see any downside to trying to secure those funds. And, you know, I would be supportive of aggressively pursuing that grant funding. Again, I'm very open to the West Avenue extension. In terms of amenities, I don't know how much direction you need today, but I think a principle I've heard from our CFO before is if we're going to do these things, let's do it right. And my final sort of request would be to continue ongoing community outreach. I know we did it before, but you know, now we're at a different level, right? Now we could actually talk about, do we need laundries and bathrooms? What do you think of this West Avenue? Constituencies that come to mind are the Sunset Harbor neighborhood, the Belle Isle residents, you mentioned Wavna, maybe our waterfront protection group. And I think the city should be complimented for its online virtual presentations. I think that's been very effective. So maybe that's another lever. And I know we've done outreach before, but we're at a different stage. And I think it would be another great idea to check in with the community. But I like the direction that this is going.
Commissioner Richardson, do you have anything to add?
No, I think this all sounds great. I remember dealing with mooring issues in 2012 in the State House, and it took 5 years to get some little laws changed that so we could move some boats off of the backyard of some people. So I like the way this is going. I appreciate your leadership on this, sir. Thank you.
Yeah, so I also support extending the study so that we can include the Wavner neighborhood all the way down to Fifth Street. So the other thing is, so that we keep it in front of us, that we don't only think about mooring fields as sort of a defensive strategy to root out sort of some of the bad derelict vessels and some of the bad behavior we see, but also as a community asset where maybe we attract a better class of tourists because the boating community is strong and getting bigger as baby boomers retire and seek to, you know, have lives on sailboats and boats. You know, we can make our community very attractive for them, get fees for their tying up in our mooring fields, and then support the local businesses on the Bayside. So this could be something that's good for us as well as smart and defensive. Okay.
Commissioner Areola, I would like to... I do want to note that the feasibility study did suggest, if the city was interested, a harbor master building. During the public outreach portion of back in 2019 and 2020, that was an item that had been was discussed by the community, asking if there was upland facilities, where would they go? From what's required from a permitting standpoint, we would need to identify bathrooms, but amenities such as showers are nice to have, but not a necessity. So I think those are also, that would be at the right time direction that we would need of what type of upland facilities the mooring field would have.
Sorry, Betsy, what do you need for us specifically? Just direction to study it? Or is that a recommendation already being made by the consultants?
The consultants recommended that there be upland facilities. There wasn't agreement from the community exactly of, you know, what that would look like. So I think we would need direction if that's something that we want to include in the budget request for fiscal year 21-22 and, you know, where those facilities would be located and what they would consist of.
Commissioner Richardson. Okay, Commissioner Richardson, see your hand.
Yeah, I'm just asking, I'm wondering if the, if the new marina project passes in the referendum, would there be any opportunity, especially if we moved south on West Avenue, would there be any opportunity for that potential operation to be a shower bathroom station? Of course, I'm sure they would have to charge money. So is that something we've looked at?
I see Eric Carpenter's on the line, so I'm going to hand it over to him.
Yeah, Commissioner, we had some very preliminary conversations with the marina about our interest in doing mooring fields. The marina certainly is interested in what we're going to be doing, and they may be willing to partner with us. We don't have anything solid, but obviously there's some confluence of objectives between the marina and the mooring fields.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. So, all right. So there's an opportunity. We're going to get past November 3rd and see what the voters decide. And then If the voters decide we should move forward on that, you're saying there would be an opportunity for us to have more discussions with the operator about the those potentials, right?
Yes.
Okay. And if we were successful in making some arrangement, would that satisfy all of the geography, or would we still be looking at needing a facility more towards the north, like in the Sunset Harbor area?
Based on initial conversations, we believe that that location or within that distance would satisfy the needs.
Okay. Well, let's wait then until November 3rd, see what the voters decide. And thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that.
Yeah, I for one definitely believe we need some upland facilities to do this right, especially if it's going to be as big as it potentially may be. So I think it's smart to start thinking about a budget impact on that. And I like what you're thinking about there, Commissioner Richardson, in the event that the marina project does pass. Okay. Let's move on to item 5 is still on the agenda. This is about the economic impact of the Super Bowl, as well as talks of a free concert. I'm not sure why we're still talking about this.
Heather Sash to be brought over to handle this item.
Chair, I had initially put this on the calendar way back, if you want me to just tee it up.
Good morning, commissioners. This item is about the economic impact of the Super Bowl. I added to your documents the report from the Super Bowl host committee. They engaged a consultant, Survey Edge, to do the economic impact for them for the Super Bowl that happened on Thursday, January 30th to February 3rd. As you will see in the study, 35% of the attendees of the Super Bowl came from Kansas City, and approximately 12% came from San Francisco, leaving 54% coming from other places. The study also shows that 72% of the out-of-town guests actually went to the convention center to experience the Super Bowl experience. They created about 4,500 jobs, full-time and part-time, and they believe the total impact of the Super Bowl for the greater Miami area was $571 million. For the city of Miami Beach, the convention center saw 80,000 visitors, and they brought in approximately $3 million in revenue. On our hotels, year on year, when we compare 2019 to 2020, on the highest days, which was usually the Saturday, the average daily rate for the hotels for 2019 was $368, but during the Super Bowl, it was $938. We believe that 42% of the Super Bowl visitors traveled to Miami Beach, and that the gross spend for these visitors was approximately $29 million. We believe the overall economic impact is somewhere in the $200 million range. And these are figures that we're still working out with the GMCVB. And that's basically most of the information other than what I put in your package with respect to what we believe the impact is on the greater Miami area and for Miami Beach. Any questions, sirs?
Any questions, Commissioner Minor?
Yeah, no, thank you, Heather. And I initially put this on actually right after the Super Bowl, so it's been some time since then. I guess I got punted out waiting this report. And really, I don't think there's any doubt that the Super Bowl has a very positive economic impact on our city and our businesses. It really is. I guess when I was maybe it was too soon after the Super Bowl when I started asking some questions about it. I think it's good to have that analysis because we are waiving some fees. Obviously, it's the convention center. There's significant overtime expenses for our police. And I think as a city, especially since we do try to bring in other large events, football, for example, we have the college championship that we're bringing in. I thought it would be good to have a a literally concrete breakdown of the type of money we're bringing in. And I guess the second component of it about the concert, and I think I was satisfied actually with staff's answer about the negotiations regarding that, but I guess it led to the question, you know, what kind of negotiations can we have and what kind of what perhaps free benefits for our residents can we bring in as we are, since we are waiving quite a bit of fees, you know, perhaps that we can get something in addition in return as well.
I agree with you, Commissioner. And we work with these groups that are coming, especially large citywide groups, to make sure that there is a large public benefit, whether they're free tickets or discount tickets or free activations in the city, to make sure that we're balancing out the benefit that we're giving them and that we're receiving.
Thank you.
Commissioner Samuelin, your hand is up.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to add one quick comment. I agree with Commissioner Minor that this sort of after the fact analysis is valuable. I'm glad we're taking a rigorous approach. And I'm just going to suggest that we be perfect in terms of doing this on the front end, because really that's where the value added is, that you have a sense. And to some extent, the after fact should be a reflection on the case that was made to us. I know we do that often. So my only call would be that we make that part of our standard discipline. And I'm glad we had this discussion.
Seeing no further hands, we'll just, I guess, conclude the item. Okay, great. I know item number six is going to be about a 15-minute presentation, so let me try to take care of a couple of other items before we maybe end with that item. Next item is item number seven, which is the discussion regarding a historic preservation fund. This is my item, and I'll just sort of tee it up, and I'm not sure who from the city staff is going to talk a little bit more about where we're at, but you know, my concern, I think all of us share this concern, is as we move forward in the coming decades and face the challenges of sea level rise and climate change, putting pressure on, you know, buildings that are 100 or more years old, what can we do in order to protect them for the next century and future generations? And the thought that I had, like some other communities have been doing, is to create a historic preservation fund that some of these historic buildings might be able to tap into in order to help them offset the costs of increasing their resiliency to, you know, storm events and rising seas. And then the question is what would be the mechanism to create that fund, and how would we fund it? And then at some point down the road, we'd have to figure out how does one take advantage of the funds that are available for investment in the properties. Who from the staff is going to kind of tell us where we're at?
I think we have some folks from planning.
Oh, Deborah, I see Deborah. Okay.
Yes. Good morning. Good morning, commissioners. So the last time the finance committee heard this item was at the June 12th meeting. At that time, we were given direction to return to the finance committee to explore different funding sources, including private sources that city could match, that could match for the city funding. We were also asked to look at other city county models and reach out to the community to get some feedback. We did have a survey that went out with, we worked on that with the city's chief resiliency officer. In addition to questions regarding flood risk mitigation and possible funding for that, that survey did include several questions regarding a possible historic preservation fund. We got a great response. Over 400 people responded. What was interesting is an overwhelming majority of the respondents did say that they would make improvements to the property if there was a 50-50 matching grant opportunity with the city. The top three, resiliency and flood mitigation improvements that were responded to, was an engineering assessment, the introduction of green infrastructure on their property. Also, yard and driveway grading elevations, which is likely due to required harmonization with the city's right-of-way improvements. The top three items that were not directly related to flood mitigation included landscape improvements, general facade repairs, painting, and just behind painting was door and window replacement. When asked about the top three criteria that the city should consider when awarding the funding, the respondents did say that they believe properties that were vulnerable to flood risks should receive priority. Properties that have received previous damage to flooding should also be considered for funding. And finally, they did believe that the awarding of grant funds should be contingent on financial need of the applicants. So we were pleased with the results because it's very consistent with the recommendations contained in the report prepared by KCI, the city's consultant. And we are looking for further direction. Deputy Planning Director Carmen Sanchez is also on this call, and she can run through some potential funding options that we have been looking at. Thank you.
The chair has just stepped away for a minute. There he is.
Yeah, I'm going to step away. I'm listening in, but I just have child care issues right now, so I'm going to pass the gavel to Commissioner Richardson.
Perfect. Thank you. Is there more that Deborah, that we're going to hear from the administration?
Yeah, I think I'm not sure if Carmen Sanchez, the Deputy Planning Director, wanted to run through some of the funding options, but we are leaning toward the information contained in the consultant's report, which would be potentially to explore SHIP or CDBG funds. That's something that we could coordinate with Maria Hernandez to see if there's any of that funding available.
Good morning, Commissioner.
Yeah.
Good morning, Commissioner. How are you?
Good. Thank you. I know we're all interested in money here, so give us some funding options. Thank you.
Some of the funding options that were suggested by the consultant, including dedicating fees, such as the demolition fees associated with permits to this effort, and also some fees coming in from violations. With the violations fee, we're kind of hesitant on that because we certainly want people to comply rather than for us to receive revenue. That's the intent of a violation, is to bring people into compliance. The demolition fees, we think that they're small. The amount of revenue that you're going to capture is minimal, and so would not actually make a significant impact towards establishing a program. We think that more substantial would be perhaps some seed money from the City Commission, General Fund, SHIP, CDBG, sources like that, that would have a more robust impact on setting up the program. To dovetail into what Debbie had mentioned, is that what the respondents to the survey and what the consultant actually recommended was, in fact, the facade improvements that would help these buildings, replacement of windows, landscaping improvements, things of that nature, paint, railings, that would actually not only improve the quality of life, but the security of the buildings themselves. We have to start out in small steps and see what kind of an impact we make before we kind of thrust into, oh, let's raise a building. That would be fantastic, but we feel that we can make a good impact with the suggestions that have been made, which, you know, are echoed by the survey response. Also, the consultant had recommended a 50-50 split between the property owners and the city. We think that that's a good way to start, so that there's a commitment and a contribution from the property owners. There's also a suggestion to make a deed restriction so that, you know, once the property is looking wonderful and now we have new windows, new doors, that if they choose to sell, that a portion of that comes back to the city so that we can recapture and provide additional funding for future awards. So those are the recommendations. They seem to be working in other cities. Towards the back end of the report that they submitted, they have actually researched other cities and other counties. Some of the incentives that they provide are tied to density bonuses, FAR bonuses, which are not necessarily available in the beach, but actually having cash on hand and doing a 50-50 split with some deed restrictions may work for us.
Thank you. Commissioner Samuelin or Commissioner Minor, do you have any questions or comments?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. I have a couple reactions. First, I like the idea of the 50-50. I think that that is smart and makes sense. I think that this is an important that the city play a role to sort of catalyze good changes in the private sector. I do want to highlight, and Commissioner Arriola is well aware of it because he sits with me on land use, but we sort of have a sister item, a related item, making its way through on private property adaptation. And that was unanimously recommended from land use and will be coming forward. So I think it'd be important. Maybe that's going to be a learning opportunity. Maybe that will dovetail in some way. But that is going to be coming hopefully in the next month or so to the commission. And finally, we've had some discussion around public benefits. I know that FAR is not necessarily one that is as easily accessible. But at land use, Commissioner Gongora, I think had an item where we might take money, for example, if there were height grants and they would go towards, he specifically, I think, called out workforce housing. But there's no reason that we couldn't say some for workforce housing and some for a historic preservation fund. So I'm supportive of this direction. I like the idea of the city playing a role. And I guess just in closing a question, I think Deborah mentioned also third party or private sources. What did we learn about other sources of, you know, potentially private funding that we could access through grants, et cetera?
Commissioner, there's not a large amount of private funding sources. Now, with historic buildings, the state does have matching grants. However, those are eligible only for nonprofits. So potentially, there could be, depending on the type of property and the ownership of the property, there potentially could be some state funding in terms of historic preservation grants. I know there's some local organizations that also provide very small, I think Dade Heritage Trust provides very small matching grant opportunities. But in terms of a profit-making property or a privately owned home, there did not seem to be many eligible grant programs.
Right. Okay, if I may, Mr. Fletcher, I appreciate that. It doesn't sound like those grants will be the full answer, but you know, anything that's out there, I absolutely want to make sure we're fully tapping and bringing to bear, including the state and Dade Heritage, because maybe they could be a piece of the puzzle. Those are my comments, Mr. Vice Chair.
Thank you so much. Commissioner Minor, do you have anything? If not, I've got a couple of questions. So, Deborah, have we put any, has the administration put anything in writing yet in terms of recommendations if we were to go down this road, which by the way, I think is a really good idea. I love the idea of creating a fund, but have we reduced anything to writing yet in terms of recommendations?
So our recommendations will be reasonably consistent with the recommendations of our consultant in terms of how to structure this fund. I think most importantly would be to establish an independent committee to review these projects, given the planning department's role in development and development approval. We do agree with the consultant that this should be some sort of third party independent committee that reviews applications. We believe that the fund should start out as more of a pilot project at this point, limited area. The concept behind that is that if we choose a limited area, say the North Beach local districts, where this idea really came out of the North Beach master plan, that we will see the impacts of the awarding of funds much more readily than if it was spread throughout the city's historic districts. So, you know, we are supportive of this particular project. Obviously, the funding is something that we need a critical direction on.
Right. And do you have an idea in mind of because we're talking about funding and you mentioned the possibility of some seed money. Do you have an idea of how much money we would need in seed money for a pilot? Do you have a range?
Commissioner, I'll take that question. I think it depends on how many properties we're looking actually to assist. We can come back to you with a range of how much we would expect, whether it's seed money from general fund, SHIP, CDBG. We'd refer to Maria for the availability of that. But, you know, capping it at 50-50%, and then looking at a maximum amount for the actual program. So, you know, if windows start to cost you $10,000 and, you know, some of the other improvements, you know, maybe another 20. So maybe a capping of the grant to a total, or a capping of the project to a total of $40,000, $30,000, somewhere in that range. That means that half would have to come from us. So we can definitely come back to you with some initial numbers so that you can make a decision on where that would be coming from and make a recommendation to the full commission so that we can establish the program.
Great. So let me tell you what I'm thinking. And go ahead, Commissioner Samuel.
You finish. Oh. I just want to pick up on your comments when you're done.
Sure. So here's what I'm thinking. What I'd like to see, and we'll see if Commissioner Samuel thinks this is a good idea. What I'd like to see is the administration reduce their thoughts to writing, because I think it's helpful for us to be able to evaluate a plan and recommend it when we can read it and see what you're recommending, and then we could tweak it a little bit in this committee. The other thing, I agree the funding is going to be tricky because I don't think demolition dollars and so forth is going to give us enough money. I do kind of like this idea that you mentioned, Commissioner Samuelin, about the possibility of a height grant. That may be something we might be able to look at in the future. But what's on my mind right now is that, and again, we have to wait and see what the voters are going to decide on November 3rd. But if you remember, if the voters react favorably to the project at the marina, remember this, the commission already decided to allocate a minimum of $5 million to four different buckets, if you will. One of those buckets was sustainability. And so I believe the lawyers could tell us, but I believe this type of project would qualify for that bucket. And I certainly would be supportive of having some seed money come out of that. Now, we may not get that for a while because of the cash flow, but I would be even willing to front some of that money once all the restrictions are lifted and we absolutely know that we're gonna get the money. But I think as a first step, I would love to see a white paper, if you will, from the administration with the recommendation of what the program would look like, what you would recommend in terms of initial seed money, and also if you could comment on sources of state money. I know there is some state money available for historical properties that are not-for-profits and any federal. So if you could put that in your paper as well. And also if you could comment on what recommendation you would see as a cap to the the project if it's $35,000 or $40,000. So those are kind of my thoughts. And now I'll let Commissioner Samuelin jump back in. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. I think you nailed it. So, you know, I'm just going to have to underscore a few good things you said. Yes, I think an official written recommendation would be helpful. Pilot, crawl, walk, run, I believe. I agree with you. I think if the marina project were, it's the will of the voters to pass that, that sustainability fund looks like an excellent place to go. I already highlighted, as did you, the state and other private. And the only my only additional comment I would just make, and I raised this private property adaptation, and I know we're coordinating because I believe the survey sort of addressed both programs, but I would just take the results of this conversation and make sure that Amy Knowles and our CFO, John, are tied in, you know, because that program is ready, I think, to move forward to the commission soon. And maybe there's some synergy there with that effort as well, because they both have the same goals of trying to have the city play a positive role to raise awareness, education, catalyze, and sort of matching grants to get the private sector moving, because we need them to do their part. So those would be my thoughts.
Thank you. And John, can you remind me when are we meeting this? When will this committee meet in November? I can't recall. I don't have the date in front of me. Do you have that in front of you?
Yes, one sec. I think it's November 13th.
November 13th. Deborah, do you think you and Carmen can have something prepared by November 13th that we could follow up on, continue the discussion on the 13th?
Yes, Commissioner, we definitely can. We'll have something put together for you. And just, we do work very, very closely with Amy Knowles. She actually was a great help on the survey. And we understand that there's a lot of synergy between what's happening there and what we're trying to do here. So we're working hand in hand with her on moving these efforts forward. We'll definitely continue to do so. And again, there's just a great commonality in efforts.
Yeah, please include Amy. So yeah. So I think that Commissioner Samuel and I are in agreement then that we would like to have something written from the administration for the packet that will be supporting the meeting on November 13th. If you'll give us that, your recommendations in writing, that way we'll have an opportunity to react to it and perhaps make a recommendation on the 13th to send it back to the commission for action. So
absolutely.
Okay, great. Anything else on this? If not, let's move on. Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. I appreciate all the help.
Thank you. Take care, Commissioner.
Item 8 has been deferred or withdrawn rather. Let's go to number 9, discussion of the city's dependence on tourism revenues and how to mitigate. That's your item, Commissioner Samuel, if you'd like to tee it up.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. We all know that we're a tourist, hospitality-centric economy, and I don't believe that's changing anytime soon. What I think we have seen, though, is the challenges that type of economy brings. For example, we've lived through Irma. We lived through Zika. We now have COVID. And it's not like these are once a decade events. All those items are literally in the last few years. So I wanted to have what I would like to frame as sort of a strategic program as to, is there an opportunity to move the needle where we're still a tourist hospitality-centric economy, but there's some other power alleys to rely on? And I want to credit our CFO, John Woodruff, who has been a thought partner throughout this. We've really put our heads together. And I'm going to bounce it over to John, because I think what we've identified is there are some opportunities. And the goal today is to share the thinking to date, understand from you, Mr. Vice Chair, and our chair, your thoughts and perspectives, but really get a bit action oriented and say, hey, can we go after these? What are some next steps? Who can drive some of these programs? And I think John will bring it to life. Mr. Woodruff, if you would.
Yeah, absolutely. So as Commissioner Samuelin mentioned, this is kind of an umbrella item because it captures kind of an update on a lot of different initiatives going on in the city. So I'm not the expert on every single one of them here, but I think the intent is to give a broad overview and then maybe at upcoming meetings, kind of dive a little deeper into some of these as we make progress on them. So I'll just start with, we tried to put these into various buckets, I think four or five buckets, to just help get our arms around them. And the first category to me is pretty exciting. That's identifying and growing new revenue streams. So on July 29th, you may recall the commission approved Spectra Partnerships as the city's new sponsorship and naming rights consultant. So Spectra is in the process right now of meeting with various departments to identify and prioritize some potential opportunities. And as those opportunities are identified, that will be brought to the city commission for consideration. So, you know, that's, for example, we could bring back Spectra potentially in the November meeting and kind of get an update there and see what are kind of like the top five opportunities that, you know, the city could be considering here in the near future, just to give one example. The property management department is also working hard to maximize the value of city-owned assets across our real estate portfolio. To facilitate those efforts, CBRE was recently engaged to conduct an inventory review, which should be ready by the end of the calendar year. So, for example, when that review is complete, we could bring them back to the committee and have some discussion around that. A second category or bucket is recruiting new businesses or industries. Well, we were discussing the, you know, hiring a new economic development director. There was a lot of discussion about the need for business recruitment and retention, especially now given the challenges from COVID-19. And so, as you know, Raquel Williams was recently appointed as the new director. And over the next few months, you know, she'll be, along with the administration, you know, evaluating the functions and activities of the department and potentially reorganizing somewhat, you know, the resources they already have to try to reflect that new priority of business retention and recruitment. Another item, over the last several months, there's been an item to incentivize the development of office space that has been working through the land use committee and was last heard at the city commission meeting on October 14th. And so, you know, I won't go through the details of it, but really the idea there is to grant more height up to about 75 feet for mixed use buildings, commercial buildings containing a minimum of 10,000 square feet to try to incentivize you know, the kind of interior floor to ceiling space that is sought by office users and office developers and so on. So, a third category is transforming one-time funds into recurring revenue. And so a good example there that's already in the hopper is the development and ground lease agreement for the new Convention Center Hotel that was approved in 2018. And so as you might recall, that agreement included guaranteed rent payments of $2 million annually. It'll be split equally between stormwater projects, traffic reduction measures, and education initiatives. And any amounts over and above that $2 million guaranteed rent could be used for other programs or projects. So a newer project is the one that already came up in discussion, the Marina Park project that voters will consider in November. If that project was approved, we'll have one-time payment to the city of $55 million for resiliency and sustainability initiatives, affordable workforce teacher housing programs to benefit the elderly, and increasing the city's budgetary reserves. So the recurring portion of that is increased minimum annual guaranteed rent to the city of $1.9 million a year that would go up with inflation over time. So those are just some examples, and you know, over time we may have new ones that we can consider. Fourth category that we came up with is increasing reserves and ensuring tourism revenues. So we looked at ensuring the city's tourism revenues 3 years ago, and our analysis showed that the potential payouts from a parametric policy didn't really make sense given the cost of the potential premiums. From our analysis, we realized that our resort taxes here in Miami Beach are surprisingly resilient and that most shocks only resulted in 1 year of impact before rebounding to normal levels. So as a result, the administration at the time, with the support of the Budget Advisory Committee, recommended kind of a sort of self-insurance, which was to increase the city's reserve policies. So in 2019, you know, the city commission approved changes to the general fund reserve policy, which went from a minimum of 2 months to a goal of 3 months. And the resort tax reserve policy was increased more from 3 months to 6 months because there's a lot more variability in resort tax funding. And so those changes really helped us be able to navigate the COVID crisis to date and hopefully going forward, because we did have those additional one-time amounts available to us to help us out while we were creating our budget balancing plans. And it's also helped us maintain our credit ratings in the face of all the revenue loss we've been seeing due to COVID. And just a quick word on the reserves. Hopefully, we've submitted $20.9 million of COVID-related expenditures to the county for potential reimbursement from CARES Act funds. It's unclear how much we would receive yet, but so far, the amount of money we've used from reserves from both the general fund and resort tax fund to help balance the budget due to COVID has been $17.4 million, just to give you an idea. So the last category we've looked at is cost reductions. And so we worked hard in parking over the last few years to reduce that transfer we had to the general fund to zero. And then this year, especially, we worked hard to right-size the department to position it to be successful in the future. And then sanitation, we've used the zero-based budget approach to help make changes to balance that fund. And so we had it in fairly good shape. And then when parking made changes, there's some changes there that impact sanitation. So over the next few months, we'll be working on some additional cost savings ideas there with the help of the Budget Advisory Committee to help sanitation. So that was just a summary. There's a lot of different items that will hopefully help lessen the city's dependence on tourism revenues. And as we talked about earlier, we can always keep this as a standing item, for example, and bring back individual departments that are help leading some of these initiatives.
Thank you, John. I see Ms. Williams is there. Thank you for joining us. And once again, welcome to the city of Miami Beach. I want to give you an opportunity if you'd like to jump in and have any thoughts on this as well. I know that you're still getting in place so forth, and we can continue the discussion, but I'd certainly like to give you an opportunity to speak with us.
Thank you, Commissioner Richardson and Mr. Chair and Vice Chair. I think that John summarized our efforts very well in the Economic Development Department. I am doing an evaluation of some of the programs and resources that we have available to us. And so I'm looking at the sectors of the city that are mostly impacted. Obviously, the tourism industry has experienced a lot of hardship, and we're looking at ways to enhance our business community and diversify it. I'm looking at financial services firms, looking at the tech industry and the healthcare industry. The mention of office space and Class A office, that is very important to the discussion. We want to make sure that we have the inventory available to attract those types of firms to come into our city. So that's definitely one of the areas that we will be focusing on. We can also look at generating revenue through leveraging public property. There are several P3 projects that the Economic Development Department is working on that could have a significant long-term benefits for the city, including the generation of revenue. So, thank you for allowing me to touch on that, and we will have more detailed discussions as things go forward.
Okay, thanks. Commissioner Samuelin. And I see Commissioner Arriola, your hand is up. I don't know if you're back with us now.
Yeah, I've been with us. I'm driving my son to school, so I didn't want to be chairing a meeting at the same time, but I'm listening. If you don't mind, I'll chime in here. Great job, John, in your presentation. Just a couple of thoughts. I don't know that I heard you, John, talk about things like development of office product, which would bring potential, office tenants, which diversifies our local economy away from just, tourism and hospitality, and, create some daytime revenue sources as, office workers, shop and eat in local businesses, end up living in our city because they, you know, want to live near where they work. And so, you know, creating incentives for office development as a way to diversify and strengthen our economy. We see all of the, you know, private equity hedge fund type of folks moving from high tax states south, particularly to Florida, particularly to South Florida. That's one thing I definitely want us to pursue. And then even within the areas of, you know, hospitality, we can further diversify there, you know, where, you know, we are a beach destination, sort of traditionally, a, you know, a nighttime tourist place. But, you know, the mayor has been pushing us to embrace arts and culture further as a way to diversify our hospitality, tourism, economy. I think we should continue pursuing that. You know, we do have soft periods in our calendar year. How do we attract a different type of tourist during those months to smooth out our fiscal calendar? And then also, you know, how do we push for a higher-end tourist base where we get, you know, more of our hotels filled with, you know, business travelers and families and not just people who want to come for the nightlife. So, you know, not just moving away from tourism, but also maybe diversifying even within the tourism space.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. I like that. I think that's something we should look at. If you're completed, Commissioner Arreola, let's move to Commissioner Samuelin.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. And I think the chair made some really important points. I just want to add one other to the list. And again, sort of, you know, where I think we're at. I think there's a whole migration to work at home and virtual workers. And if there's anywhere, if you could work anywhere in the world, I think you should want to work from Miami Beach and do your business. So I'd like us to give some thought to, you know, is that a segment at all that we could tap? Is there something perhaps teeming with our hotels that probably have capacity where they could attract folks like that? Are we the best place for the gig work from home economy? And how do we get that word out? I just want to add that to the mix because I think that's another source of diversification. But I think John framed it well. I think our goal is, we know we're always going to have the conversation around tourism and hospitality because that's who we are. And we should do that. And that conversation would continue. This really is a program where we're going to be intentional about having conversations in these other areas. I think John's got us a good starting list and a thought, Mr. Vice Chair, on a next step would be that we sort of say, hey, this list is good enough to start with, that we'd like to say have one every month come back. We want to know who's sort of leading the charge. I'd love to hear about quantitative goals and plans to get there and, you know, see if we can start to move the needle in these various areas. So that's my thought as to where we may go from this conversation.
Thank you, Commissioner. And it's your item. So let me ask, would you like to see some specific action, like maybe a white paper on this? Or, you know, for me personally, I always like things when we reduce it to writing, because then I can look at it and add my edits and so forth. But would you like to see any action out of this today?
Yeah, I would like two things. I would like, as you called it, a white paper, something in writing. I think the CFO has got a very good first pass at what that looks like, but maybe including the comments that we made today. So adding that would be action number one. And action number two, let's get this ball going. Let's bring one of the programs that's furthest along. And I think that's probably in the communications area with Spectra. And let's get them up talking about plans and targets and how we move the needle. So those would be two specific actions that I think could come from the conversation.
Okay, great. And I would agree with that. So let's move that along, John, if we can. Let me add some of my comments. I think the presentation by the administration was great, and I agree with the comments from my colleagues. I like the chair's comment about looking at hospitality and seeing what elements of hospitality perhaps we haven't served in Miami Beach as part of this diversification. I think that's a really great idea. And your idea, Vice Mayor, about this people working from home, how we might be able to attract people, because now you can work anywhere. You know, I've been a big supporter of getting more Class A office space in the city. I think that's really critical. I just saw the other day that Paul Singer has announced he's moving his hedge fund to Florida. And I would love to get that in Miami Beach. But I know that a limitation that we have is that we need more Class A office space. And I'm hoping the city's going to really move forward with that. But I would like, Ms. Williams, for you, and you know, based on our initial conversations, that I feel very strong about the economic development part of your office. And I think I told you several times that I'm not going to let community development absorb all your time and allow you to lose the economic development piece, because I think that they are equally important. So, you know, one of the things you mentioned is tech, and I would really like you to explore that a little more, because tech firms don't normally require Class A office space, especially in their early stages, perhaps when you're Apple, but I'll work on getting Apple to relocate to Miami Beach another day. But I think that tech is something we could really look at, because we've got adequate space, office space for that sector right now. So please continue to explore that area. So John, when do you think it would be feasible to bring us something in writing? Do you think that you could do that by the 13th, November 13th?
Yeah, well, as Commissioner Samuelin noted, you know, we do have a start on that. We wrote a memo. It covers a lot of ground, so it can get pretty detailed pretty quickly. But I think the benefit of it is that, one, you can see and get into that detail if you wanted to, but also it helps us get our arms around the bigger picture of what we're trying to accomplish. And so, yeah, I believe for November 13th, we can definitely update the memo, get it a little bit more detailed, include the other items that we discussed. And then I'd just like to double check with Tanya. I think she's on the call, if she feels that Spectra would be good to go with at least some preliminary ideas on the 13th. Does that sound doable, Tanya?
It does, John. I can tell you, we've been meeting with them weekly. We actually just got to meet the final candidate that they intend to potentially hire to focus solely on our contract. They're also coming to Miami Beach next week. I'm going to be taking them around to all of our facilities and having them talk to some of the different department directors in person. They've talked with almost all of them virtually already about events and opportunities and sponsorships. We've preliminarily talked about numbers and expectations. So I believe that they're more than ready to give a presentation and give some ideas on the 13th.
Okay. So if that's okay with you, Commissioner Samuelin, we will continue the item to the November 13th. And on the 13th, and that packet will have a white paper, some presentation written form from the administration, and also a presentation from Spectrum. Is that okay with you?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. Let's move forward then. We'll close that item out and continue it until November 13th. Let's move to item. Item 10, I think, has been deferred. And so item 11, discussion regarding the city of Miami policies to retain tenants during the pandemic. This is your item, Commissioner Samuelin. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. You know, the pandemic has been such a tragic time for everyone in so many different dimensions. Obviously a health crisis, but also an economic challenge for so many businesses. And I think this actually dovetails on the discussion that we had, because one of the areas of focus for diversification, John mentioned, is the city assets and the city properties and how we best leverage them. And so it struck me that, you know, we're a landlord and we have a lot of property and we've got tenants. And so I think what I wanted to start a conversation, and I think it's Adrian Morales, who I know has been given some good thought to this, how do we best address the challenges that some of our tenants are doing in a fair and equitable way? And how do we make sure that we continue to activate our communities? And where is our thinking on this? Because, you know, a high percentage of zero is not a good number. So if we lose businesses, that's a problem. And so it was in that spirit, I wanted to hear from the administration, and perhaps we could recognize Adrian, sort of walk us through the situation, some ideas and where we may go. Because I know there are some specific businesses, too, that are feeling really under the gun.
Okay. Go ahead, Adrian. And thank you, Adrian, once again, for all the support you and your folks have given me with the food distribution stuff. It's amazing how hard your team works to support us in the city. And I just want to publicly say thank you. I appreciate it. So go ahead. Let us know what you're thinking on this.
I appreciate that. Good morning, everyone. And Commissioner Simon, thank you for putting this item on. We had an opportunity to, you know, take a look at our portfolio and to dovetail into the conversation that John had. It's trying to maximize, you know, our portfolio in a post-pandemic economic recovery. You know, I'm currently acting as the asset manager. You know, our asset manager moved on and you know, in his place, and we're going to find somebody that can assist with this task over the next few months. But in the interim, you know, I've had an opportunity to dive into every single one of our agreements and try to, you know, identify opportunities. Some of the tenants that we have reached out to us and to other commissioner offices and try to, you know, seek some assistance. To give you some background, when we had the emergency orders, the safer at home orders that the city was essentially locked down at the height of the pandemic, the city suspended rents from the period of April through fiscal year 20, September 30th. So we did that and we memorialized that via commission in October. Excuse me, I believe we did it in September. We gave them a break. As we come out of that into fiscal year 21, you know, my office working closely with budget, we're trying to identify the fiscal impact of carrying those lost revenues if we were to continue to suspend rents. You know, it's not cookie cutter across the board. There are very unique agreements. You know, we have operator agreements, we have percentage rent agreements, we have agreements with the minimum guarantees, we have traditional lease agreements. So we're looking at every single option. And I've already met with some of the tenants, for example, and I think she'll be on the call, you know, Yucca 105 on Washington Avenue, you know, they just opened for the first time in February, towards the end of February. They opened for a few weeks and they've been closed since, and they don't expect to open to December. The investment was, you know, millions of dollars over 3 years, and they really had less than a month open. So that's something that, you know, it's in our best interest to have that tenant there. You know, how we work with that operator to, you know, potentially defer some rents, to potentially, you know, at the committee's direction and the commission's direction to suspend or even waive, give them opportunities to catch up, providing financials. Those are all of the things that we're seeking kind of direction on and we'll be tasked with putting this together. But I think over the next few weeks and even to the next few finance committees, we can get it with our budget department and try to see what our fiscal impact for our fiscal year 21 budget and beyond. And then, you know, working with our tenants to make sure that they survive. There's another deal that was, you know, very popular last year in Marie Blachère, which is a bakery that was going to go on Anchor Garage. That tenant hasn't signed a deal because they're on hold. They're scared and they're not sure if they want to continue to invest in that project in this economy. So like I said, it's a matter of sitting down and going through every single one of these opportunities and working on a path to make sure that we keep our tenants.
Thank you. John, maybe you could tell us before we jump in with discussion how we treated the city properties in our budget that we just adopted. Did we have we done an estimate at a certain percentage level? Do you recall what we did in the current fiscal year budget that we just adopted?
I know we discounted it to some degree. I don't have that information handy, but I could certainly have it ready for the next discussion. But yes, we did not assume we would get 100%. That's for sure.
Okay. Commissioner Samuel, what would you like to do with this item? Tell us your dream.
Yep. My dream, and I have a few of them, but my dream as it relates to this item is that we probably need to continue it to the next meeting, allow Adrian a little more time. I think he just got that hat really recently. And then I know he's going to want to connect with John, who wants to play those numbers. I was looking to start the conversation. So, of course, if my colleagues have comments, would welcome them and then bring it back. But I just want to go on the record saying I am glad we're taking a holistic view of our portfolio. I appreciate what we did to get it to this point. And now what I'm hearing is we're going to be thoughtful, empathetic, and analytical to make the right decisions. And I stand open and prepared to receive the written recommendations from the administration and put our finance thinking behind it. And I'll look forward to hearing it at the next meeting.
Okay. Commissioner Arriola, go ahead.
Yeah, so, it's very clear that we should be trying to support, particularly, local businesses, small businesses, our tenants. We want to keep them, we want to help them stay healthy. But so I'm thinking about this, we're in a unique position as a public entity, relative to private. Everything we do is public. So, things like rent relief and, different accommodations we might make for a tenant, that's public information. Mm-hmm. So, I worry how we do this so that we don't send a signal to folks that are, current on rent and paying rent, and then they find out that other people who have fallen behind are getting, certain, accommodations, and then they're going to say, well, why can't we get the same accommodations, which would be a fair request. And then we have the unintended situation where everybody's getting, 6 months rent relief and other accommodations, and we make a bad situation worse. So I don't know how we sort through that, but I want us to think about, what might happen if we start helping, a couple of tenants. Are we going to then open the floodgates to every tenant of the city? That could be real big dollars. And I don't know the answer, but I was just thinking about it as we were having this discussion. I don't know if John has given that any thought, but I can see that being an issue.
Mr. Chair, if I may, it's Adrian.
Yeah, go ahead.
I agree with Commissioner Arriola, and look, there are some operators and some tenants that have been open and are producing. A good example is our concession operator on the beach. They're open. The beach is open. So we wouldn't treat them the same as the Live Nation or the Jackie Gleason that's been dark since March. That's the part of this process, which is why I don't have a cookie cutter answer. It's to evaluate every single agreement and, working with our tenants, part of this developing a process, perhaps a tenant, relief application process, if you will, that can allow for them to provide some type of financials or some type of, document that the city could review. And then, we would go based off of that. If their gross sales are a certain number and you have a percentage rent type of deal, and obviously that's affected by it. So it's a collaborative effort between our budget office, our economic development director, and then the administration in the manager's office to try to get, the best approach where it's not, cookie cutter and we're just giving away revenue opportunities.
Yeah, thank you. And I think Commissioner Arriola brings up a really good point. I was thinking that, I could hear a potential lessee saying, wow, I'm lucky that I rented space in a city facility versus from a commercial because I'm getting it's a slippery slope. I could even see someone in a commercial lease situation saying, well, why don't you collect the rent from the folks in the city facilities and take that rent money and provide grant opportunities for people in commercial. So I think it's slippery. So let's continue this till next month. I think John, if you could by the 13th bring back to us the amounts that we have put in the budget, just so we will have a frame of reference on what we initially pass. And then I don't know that you're going to be ready on the 13th, Adrian. It's not that far away to talk to us about the details of what you're going to do. But maybe I think, at least from my perspective, I would love to see your first shot at that for our December meeting. What I don't want to happen, and by the way, I think the way the administration handled the first 6 months of the pandemic crisis was acceptable and good for our tenants. But what I don't want is I don't want time to pass so that we are in the summer of next year, close to the end of our fiscal year, when we're making decisions on how we're going to treat the whole fiscal year. So I think we have to get a handle on this sooner rather than later. And hopefully by December, you'll be able to give us your initial thoughts. But if it's okay with you, Commissioner Samuelin, let's continue this item until the 13th. Let's get our hands around the dollar amounts that are in the budget so that we at least have a frame of reference on what we're looking at. And then maybe in the December timeframe, we'll be ready to hear from the administration on their first pass at what their recommendation is. Is that okay with you?
Yeah, it sure is, Mr. Vice Chair. And I think you and the chair brought up very important points. You know, how do you address people fairly? How do you do it without opening up the floodgates, but recognize the uniqueness of certain tenant situations where I think we have, you know, unique situations or perhaps different transactions and agreements we made historically. So I look forward to the next steps exactly as you laid out.
Thank you. And one other thing, John, that maybe you guys could look at for us for the 13th is, you know, we've been talking a lot about rent assistance on the private sector side. I don't know if the federal government or state money identified any rent assistance for commercial activity, but maybe you could look into that by the 13th and let us know if there's any money in CARES. Just let us, you could brief us on that on the 13th. That would be great. So with that, let's move on if that's okay with everybody. And now I think we'll go back to the remaining item, which is number 6, discussion regarding financial plan for the water and sewer system master plan. John, who's going to tee this up? I think this is from Public Works.
Yeah, I believe it's Roy Coley, and I'm here to help as well as we move into this.
And Mr. Vice Chair, there was one other item, the Shane Center, that was added last night as item 31.
Okay. All right, let's go ahead and do number 6, and then we'll get to the added item. So is Roy with us? Go ahead, Mr. Foley, you're recognized.
Yes, sir, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Roy Coley, the Director of Public Works. Back in March of this year, the City Commission, at this committee's recommendation, adopted a critical infrastructure plan from the Public Works Department for its water and wastewater system. That plan cost in excess of $122 million and was identified as necessary to prevent the failure of our aging infrastructure. The commission adopted this, also made available to the Public Works Department existing resources that were on hand at this committee's recommendation to initiate the critical infrastructure plan, and then directed us to immediately begin a rate study and a financial capacity analysis, and which we did and we have completed. We have a consultant with us today that helped us develop this, and he has a presentation to show you his analysis. I'm going to introduce him, and while I do that, I'm going to ask him, I see he's joined the meeting, to go ahead and share his screen and get the presentation queued up to save time. His name is Brian Metz. He's the president of GovRates. a rate financial and management consulting firm headquartered in Florida. They work all over the United States and Canada on rate and financial plans. Mr. Mance has been involved in the development of several utility industry manuals on rates and charges. He currently serves as the co-chair of the publication arm of the American Water Works Association National Rate and Charge Committee. He's written many articles and papers on the subject. He's won awards on the subject. He's a certified management consultant, a certified government financial manager, has a Series 50 qualified municipal advisor representative. He's been involved with Miami Beach now since 2016 when he helped us develop the current rate that we have. And we're going to ask him now to share his screen and show the presentation and walk you through it. And then we'll all be prepared to answer questions.
Okay. Brian, are you ready? Sure. Can everyone see my screen?
We do not see your screen with the presentation yet.
Okay, let's see.
If you're unable to show it, I think we have it on standby that that our communications team can run for you if you don't have it, Brian.
Okay, let's see. I have the share screen option. Let's see. I do apologize.
I have the same complications and difficulties. Tanya, is Tanya here? Is there someone in communications that can pull, do you know if we have the deck, we could put it up?
PJ is, I believe, getting it up right now.
Oh, okay. There it is. So, Brian, if you would, while they're putting this up, just as you go through it, just say next slide and they will advance it for you. Here's your presentation.
Okay. I think I just had a,
He has it up now.
All right. Can everyone see my screen now?
Yes.
All right. Great. Each of these virtual programs has different, little things associated with it. Thank you, Roy. For the record, my name is Brian Mance, and of course, I'm here to talk about the water and sewer rate study. And as we talked about, this is probably going to be a 15 to it's about a 20 slide presentation. It should, I'll hopefully get through it in about 15 minutes. So when we talk about the city of Miami Beach's water and sewer utility, we're talking about an entity that provides an essential service on a continuous basis where public health and safety is the primary objective. It's also a highly regulated entity, and regulatory bodies include the Florida Department of Environmental Protection, the South Florida Water Management District, the Florida Department of Health, and the Environmental Protection Agency. And permits that are issued by these regulatory agencies require compliance with regulations. And it's also accounted for as an enterprise fund where operations are primarily funded through user rates and fees. And the last rate study was completed in 2016. It's essentially a large business of the city, and there are about $350 million installed cost of utility assets under city management. So let's talk about the major cost factors affecting the water and sewer utility system. As Roy mentioned, there's about $122.2 million in critical capital needs that are recognized through fiscal year 2024. These are based on the most recent utility master plan findings and were previously communicated to the City Commission. And they're primarily replacements or rehabilitations of utility assets that are reaching the end of their service lives to continue providing reliable water and sewer service. Here's a kind of a high-level summary of the critical capital needs. As you can see, the most capital needs are water main replacements, with secondary booster and pump station projects, and also with the third one being sewer main replacements, both force mains and gravity mains, which, you know, these are just, again, a high-level summary. When we talk about utility infrastructure, it's often out of sight and out of mind. And, you know, these are some pictures just that kind of communicate what some of the city's infrastructure, is obviously in need of renewal and replacement. Here you can see a picture of a water main needs to be replaced. Obviously, it's a very old main, needs some attention. And here on the sewer side, here's a sewer pump station infrastructure that needs to be replaced. You do have some aging infrastructure in the city that needs to be, you know, addressed as part of this ongoing renewal and replacement program. With respect to funding of the needs, we're expecting that $50 million of it would come from the issuance of additional bonds in 2022. This was also recognized back in 2017 when the city issued the Series 2017 bonds. It was recognized another bond issuance of about $50.2 million was recognized. About $48.3 million of the program is projected to be funded from the remaining proceeds from the Series 2017 bonds, with the rest as pay-as-you-go funding. And as I mentioned, the $50.2 million is consistent with what was previously recognized during the 2017 bond issuance. We've also recognized there's about $93 million in similar capital needs for 2025 and to 2030, and those are projected to be funded basically on a pay-as-you-go basis. And this financial plan that that's being presented assumes the refunding of the utility's outstanding Series 2010 bonds, which we'll talk about in just a second. Certainly another item we have to consider is that operating expenses are projected to continue increasing. And when we talk about inflation and increases in operating costs, it's important to recognize that these are essentially permanent increases in costs, and they must ultimately be passed through to ratepayers through the monthly user rates. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, despite the pandemic, is still projecting inflation to continue for the foreseeable future. Miami Beach purchases all of its water and from Miami-Dade County, and also Miami-Dade treats all of the city's sewer. We've been passing through increases, wholesale rate increases from the county, and these are uncontrollable costs that represent nearly 60% of water and sewer operating expenses. And another operating expenses is what we call a DERM fee. It's a fee from the Department of Environmental Resources Management, equal to 6% of retail revenues that's paid to the county for regulation of the city's utility. But certainly due to the regulatory environment and the capital-intensive nature of the utility operations, as well as commodity cost increases, utility costs typically increase at a higher rate than general inflation. Another thing in looking at the rate and financial plan is the need to maintain adequate debt service coverage. And the rate covenants associated with the city's outstanding bonds are basically formal agreements between the city and bondholders. And it's appropriate to target more than the required coverage percentage so that you can provide more pay-as-you-go funding for routine or recurring capital needs. And as we've talked about, there is an opportunity to refund the utility's existing Series 2010 bonds to save about $16.5 million in debt service payments during the forecast period and also improve the utility's debt service coverage. So with respect to the refinancing of the Series 2010 bonds, this is something that has been discussed before, and in working with assumptions provided by the the city's financial advisor. This chart here shows the potential increase, a decrease in annual debt service if the Series 2010 bonds are refunded. And you can see it's about $16.5 million from 2021 to 2030 in terms of the savings and the payments. So with respect to making projections, we did use a 10-year forecast period, and a key assumption was a 3-year economic recovery period. We're assuming that by 2023, things will be back to normal. And when we look at revenue requirements, we look at a holistic approach. We look at operation and maintenance expenses, capital improvement program funding through rates, debt service coverage requirements, any kind of administrative transfers. All these elements together make up what are known as the annual revenue requirements that we need to fund through our system of rates and charges. So the projected need for revenue adjustments. So the water system adjustments are slightly higher than the sewer system adjustments. Overall, we're recommending with respect to the amount of additional revenue that's needed, we're recommending 2.4% in 2021, which includes the increases in the wholesale, the systems, the utilities, water and sewer wholesale rates in 2021. And then moving forward, we're showing the need for 2.3% additional revenue in addition to revenue that would be generated from passing through future wholesale rates from Miami-Dade County. And I can't, and you know, certainly from a best financial management practices, smaller incremental increases over time help to avoid future rate shock and higher catch-up rate increases. And I can't emphasize how advisable the smaller incremental increases approach is. Last week, I had to present a 48% rate adjustment to a utility to a governing body for a utility in Colorado that had not raised their rates in 6 years. Last year, I had to present a 95% rate adjustment to a utility that had not really had a formal rate study in a long time. And so, again, those kinds of discussions, a 48% and a 95% adjustment, those are not pleasant discussions to have for all parties involved. So again, I can't emphasize how advisable it is for the smaller incremental increases over time. And certainly with respect to the effect on the bills, the bill increases would be fairly moderate. These are the bill increases under the proposed rate design, which I'm going to talk about in a few minutes. And with respect to, you know, if you were to take your bill and divide it by the number of gallons, this kind of shows you how much what the cost is per gallon. As you can see, you compare 1.6 and 1.7 cents per gallon compared to a gallon of some other commodities you might buy. And it helps to kind of communicate the value of water and sewer essential service. So our projected financial position should enable the utility to accomplish multiple key objectives. Obviously, we need to fund our operating capital needs. We'd like to avoid the credit rating being downgraded, which would result in higher interest rates. We'd like to lock in the debt service savings through the refunding of the Series 2010 bonds. We'd like to prepare the utility for the next bond issue in a few years. It'd be great if we could have a plan in place so that the utility doesn't need to conduct another rate study in order to be able to issue this next issue of bonds to fund the critical capital needs. And it does enable us to maintain affordable and competitive rates. There are financial risks of not adjusting rates at this time. Obviously, we're not going to be able to fund all the revenue requirements and fund the capital program, meet our debt service requirements, and meet our financial targets. and user rates may be even higher in the future. I showed you some pictures of some sample renewal and replacement needs. These needs will not go away, but will most likely be more expensive to address in the future because inflation and the cost of construction continue to affect system costs. So these charts here kind of show, if we took no action, what would be the effect? And here you can see if we didn't raise any rates for the foreseeable future, you can see we would run into issues with our coverage, and we'd quickly run out of cash. We wouldn't be able to fund anything, which could certainly lead to operational issues. Now, with respect to the rate design, we are recommending gradually increasing the base charge recovery to promote revenue stability. Most operating expenses and all debt service are fixed, and the effects of COVID-19 and the anticipated additional debt financing support the notion of increasing base charge recovery. Current base charge recovery is about 8%. The utility industry recommended level is about 30%. And the current base charges are significantly below the average of nearby communities. We got about 29 surveyed utilities. You can see that the city's base charges are the water and sewer are about $17.69 combined, compared to which are less than half of what the average of neighboring utilities are. And so we're proposing some baby steps or small steps to gradually increase the base charge recovery to promote revenue stability. We've right-sized the purchased water and sewer components of the rate structures based on the latest flow data. We're maintaining the relationships among customer classes consistent with those that were recognized in the 2016 rate study. And with respect to the satellite sewer rates, which are established through contract, we're recommending about a 3.6% increase for those customers. Now, with respect to how the city's rates compared with those of neighboring utilities, you can see that with the proposed rates for 2021, the city's position on this comparison graph do not even change. With the you're still in the same area on the graph. A key takeaway from this comparison is to see all these utilities that have a little asterisk next to them. These are utilities that are either involved in a rate study, they're planning to conduct a rate study, or they plan to implement a rate revision or price index or pass-through adjustment within the next 12 months following the comparison preparation date. And this is virtually all of them. So the idea being that as these other utilities are reviewing their rates and adjusting their rates accordingly, the city's rates will continue to be competitive. But it is important to recognize when looking at a comparison that it's not a report card on how well a utility is performing, because there are a lot of reasons why user rates differ among utilities. Certainly the treatment process has, for the utilities that have their own treatment facilities, whether they're treating fresh water or brackish water or salt water has an effect. The size of the customer base and available system growth, the level of capital improvement programs to meet service area growth, all of these have an influence on the rates charged. Each utility has its own set of circumstances. And so it's a discussion item, but it's not a report card. So what we're proposing, the plan that we're proposing to move forward with to the commission would be to adopt a proposed schedule of water and sewer rates for fiscal year 2021 through 2025. We talked about how smaller or incremental rate increases over time help to avoid future rate shock and catch-up increases. The rates are considered affordable, competitive, and affordable. The common metric used in the utility industry is 4.5% of median household income. If your combined water and sewer bill is less than 4.5%, it's considered affordable, and we're well below 4.5%. The plan is going to favorably position the utility for the issuance of additional bonds to fund, again, some of the critical capital needs in a few years. And when you're issuing bonds, it is important to show third-party evaluators, such as credit rating agencies, that all the increases needed to support the debt have already been adopted. So, and again, you know, we're hoping that this plan would you know, we can put a plan in place and not have to have another rate study prior to any issuance of the additional bonds. We do recommend gradual increase in the base charge recovery percentage, and of course, we would certainly certainly it's imperative that the city pass through future wholesale rate increases from Miami-Dade County per the formula in the city code. We do recommend the approval, the refunding of the Series 2010 bonds. We've assumed that in this financial forecast. If to the extent that the city does not move forward with the refunding, we're going to have to look at relook at the recommendations. But we did, you know, as I talked about, we're recognizing potential debt service fundings of savings about $16.5 million, which makes it, in my opinion, a no-brainer. And certainly, we want to monitor the actual versus projected financial results. As I mentioned, we're assuming a three-year economic recovery, but we're going to have to monitor the effects, the long-term effects of COVID-19, as well as other changes in possible customer usage trends, the regulatory environment, capital needs, et cetera, and update the financial and rate plan as needed. And that concludes my presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Mance. Roy, did you have anything you want to add on the backside of this before we have some discussion?
No, sir. Just at the end of this, we're asking for you to recommend to the commission as a whole to adopt this rate schedule. We would be joining with Rafael Paz next week to develop the language to alter our existing ordinance based on what you approve today, assuming you approve, and then we'll see you at the next commission meeting.
Mr. Paz, do you have anything you want to add to that?
No, sir. So the way that this would work in an ordinance amendment is that the commission would be approving a total increase now of the aggregate amount of the 11.6%, and the ordinance would specify that it would be phased in over a five-year period, and it would specify exactly the percentage as noted in the memo and in Brian's presentation each year, so that this is approved once and then automatically updated each year with the fee schedule.
Commissioner Samuelin, did you want to jump in here and give any thoughts, sir?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. No one ever likes to have this conversation about prices going up, increased fees. So not an easy conversation, but an important one. I do think a few things are bright notes that I'll highlight, and then I have a couple questions. First is the refinancing and the savings that we would be enjoying. That seems like a pretty good no-brainer. Second, I do like the incremental approach broadly that, you know, as opposed to talking about double-digit increases, it's a little more bite-sized approach. So I think that's good. And I think the thought that Rafael underscored of, you know, making one decision and then that decision for those increases will be executed is preferred than having this conversation every year or every 18 months. Now, these increases in part are going to support a plan that has been presented to us and a program that's underway. So my first question is, I think it's important for all of us in the public to understand sort of how did we get to this point with the needs that we have? I mean, Roy, how old is some of this infrastructure And when was the last time we did such a program, $120 million, water and sewer? You know, I'm just trying to make sure everyone understands how we got here.
Well, Commissioner, simply put, our city's more than 100 years old, and much of its infrastructure was installed at the beginning of the city. We have water lines that we've documented installed in the 1920s in multiple places in town, and that they're just simply at the end of their useful life. They're 100 years old. We have other water lines that are 70 or 80 years old. We have fire flow challenges in a number of areas. It's just a simple fact that we are at the end of their useful life. In many cases, I believe, in my professional opinion, we're beyond their useful life, and we are living with risk right now that we may not be mindful that we have, that we may not have sufficient flows in the event of a major fire. We also have some very critical sewer line issues where pipes are simply too old. We've seen what happens in our neighboring communities when they just completely fail and fill their neighborhoods full of sewage. We've had a couple of minor sewage incidents by comparison where contractors have hit our lines, and we all know what an inconvenience and a problem it's been. If these pipes, if we allow them to go until they just completely fail, we're going to have an environmental disaster in our community. This is what we recognize as must be done in an attempt to prevent that from happening and to reduce our risk. And it's something that, you know, we could easily say should have happened 20 years ago or 30 years ago. I wasn't here then. I don't know what the financial limitations were. I don't know what the willingness of the community to do things like this was. So I won't attempt to speak to it. I will say it's an absolute certainty. This work needs to be done if you want to reduce your risk of catastrophic utility failure.
Yeah. And Roy, you made a couple important points. One, you know, we certainly feel bad for other municipalities that have had some of these issues that have been very visible, and we certainly don't want to be in that position. And just to be 110% clear, I said it before, but maybe you could just validate these projects. Some of this work we're talking about already has begun. This is happening as we speak, correct?
Yes, sir. What you did at the commission level was approved some 20 odd million dollars worth of available money at that time for us to begin with. We took that money and immediately started replacing some failing water lines and preparing designs for some sewer pump station rehab. So we're spending that money now and moving as fast as we can on design work.
Yeah, no, that's consistent with my expectation. My own view, and there was a lot of good information to digest, but I'm not one to say that we should be kicking the can down the road. You know, we could probably sit here and wish some people 20 years ago had done it. It would have made our jobs a little bit easier. But I'm not of one to kick cans down the road when the need is clear. So my last sort of question would be, you know, given that we need more funds, I think that is a given, and I believe we need to proceed with making our infrastructure more resilient for the future. I see the recommendation on the table. It's in writing, which I know my colleague likes. It's clear. It's even in yellow. Do we have any options if our colleagues have is there another flavor you want to share with us? You know, is there anything else that you would like us to consider besides what's written in yellow and I'm jumping off the page? And I just want to understand what our choices are.
No, Commissioner, I think we've made you the most palatable recommendation. Of course, identifying refunding old bonds that at the end puts about $16 million of cash in our pocket, like we said and characterized, that's a no-brainer. That's like free money that we've been able to identify. We're spending all available reserves we've got, and we're 50-some-odd million dollars short to make this $122 million plan. I don't want to speak for John, our CFO, but I doubt John's got $50 million laying around that he doesn't need anywhere. And this is an enterprise fund. It is supposed to support itself. A 2.4% increase in rates this year and a 2.3% increase for the next 4 years to reduce our risk of catastrophic failure is a very reasonable number. I realize nobody wants it to be raised, including me. I don't want my utility bill raised either, but this is something that we have to do, and I don't have any options for you unless you want to live with more risk.
Right. Well, I don't love the idea of living with more risk. It's prudent we're having this conversation. My final comment would be, I think however we proceed, and we do need to do something here, there's no doubt about that. It's very important that we communicate around this issue. You know, this type of infrastructures, the only time you think about it is when it's not working or when you see it. So I believe it's very important that the public understand that some of it, and Roy, you made these points, some of it could be like 100 years old. I think it's important for the public to understand we have a $120 million program that is actually underway. I think it's important for this to be communicated, whether it's a little insert with a bill when we get to that point, whether it's something that we do through social media. But this is important for us to be resilient. And I think we do need to take some sort of action. I look forward to my colleagues' thoughts.
Thank you, Vice Mayor. You made a lot of great points that I wanted to make as well, so I won't repeat those, other than to say the refinancing or the retirement of that debt, I think, is a no-brainer for the 2010 bonds. Have we looked at the 2017 bonds? I thought I saw that on the screen. Is there an opportunity to retire that debt at lower rates now? Have we looked at that? Is that a possibility?
I'll let Brian speak to that, but I don't think it is yet callable. We've not reached that call date.
Okay.
I did speak with the city's financial advisor about that, and she said that right at this time it's not really something that would save the city money at this time.
Is that because the interest rate is favorable, or that it is not callable? Do you know?
I believe that it's the interest rate.
Okay. All right. And what this $122 million that we need now, if I understand correctly, is going to take us basically, it's a 5-year plan, I think. So what happens after this 5 years? Do we have a 20-year plan, or do we have a 10-year plan? So let's say we spend the $122 million for critical needs. What's going to happen in 5 years? Are we going to have another $100 million at that point, or do we know what the next 10 years looks like? So you're presenting 5 years. What happens the next 5 years after that?
Yes, sir. What we did was work with Hazen and Sawyers, our consultant for water and sewer, and we did develop a long-term plan, which was a 20-year renewal and replacement plan of the utilities. And during that process, where we developed hydraulic models and mapping of our system, our consultant came to us and said, you have a list of things in this long-term plan that we're classifying as critical because they're beyond their useful life, and you need to move on this immediately. That's where the $122 million critical plan came from, was the items that our consultant felt like were at imminent danger of failure, and we needed to replace. And of course, at the end of that period, we're out of the critical phase. And as Brian mentioned in his presentation, we intend to go forward with pay-as-you-go funding to continue renewal and replacements on our long-term plan that we do have. And we have submitted that long-term plan to land use. Land use has seen it. And we shared that plan back in January at a resiliency retreat. We showed the whole plan, but we did focus primarily on the importance of the 5-year portion.
So what is the, after this 5-year period, let's say from 2025 to 30, that 5-year, you're saying you're anticipating it'll be pay as you go, but are we looking at $100 million? Are we looking at $50 million, $10 million? Do we have a rough order of magnitude?
We do. It's more than $100 million phased in over 15 years, and that's what we intend to be able to pay as we go.
So after this 5-year period of the critical, the 122, you're saying from 2025 forward for 15 years, you're anticipating about $100 million over a 15-year period after this 5-year.
It's more than 100. I don't know the exact number. I would have to look that up and get back to you to give you the exact number. It's more than 100, but yes, over 15 years, unless Brian has it handy.
Brian, do you have that?
Yeah, we've got it's about $93 million over the next 5 years. That's beyond from 2026 to 2030, we've recognized about $93 million of extra that would be funded on a pay-as-you-go basis.
Okay.
And with respect to adjustments after that, after the 2025, where we're just looking at CPI and pass-through adjustments.
Okay. And then, so 122 for the next 5 years, and then 26 through 30, you're looking at 93, which would be pay as you go. And then because I think I heard Roy say you have a 20-year plan, what about the next 10 years from 2030 to 2040? Do we have an estimate of what that number would be?
We do have that full 20-year plan. I don't have that number in front of me, but I did remember it being more than 100 million. So I would just have to report back that total number.
Okay. All right. And Vice Mayor Samuel, I think you raise a really great point about communication. It's so critical that we let people know what we're doing, the benefits that the community are going to receive from this, but there's going to be a cost associated. And I share your view that we should not kick the can down the road. I wish that somebody had done this 20 years ago, and we'd be looking at something different. So since I have the gavel, I can't move the item. And so would you like to move it?
Yep, I'll move it.
Then I will second it. I would like to add a couple of things to it. And let me throw that out there and see if the vice mayor agrees. So in addition, so we're moving a recommendation to the commission. What I would like to see is when you present this to the commission, I would like to see a communication plan. So I would like to see how, and maybe that's going to be Tanya, I'd like to see what steps you're going to take to communicate this to the community if it's adopted. The other thing that I would recommend that you add to the slide deck is just talk for 1 minute about the 20-year plan, because I think we need to have that as a frame of reference. I think people need to know that if we adopt this 5 years, there's going to be another 5 year and another 10-year. This is a 20-year plan. The other thing that I think you should be prepared to explain, and we don't have to do it now because you don't have those detailed numbers, is if we're having to do rate increases and we're doing some retirement debt for this 122, Brian just said there's 93 that's going to be in the next 5 years, and that's going to be all pay as you go. And so the budget guy in me says, how do you do 93 pay as you go when you're having to pull from three different sources, including pay as you go, to do the 122? So I think you guys should look at those numbers and be prepared to talk to the full commission about the 93 pay as you go, because, I've got some alerts going up that I'm not sure that you're going to be able to do that without significant increases beyond at higher rates than what we're talking about today. But I don't want to kick this can down the road. I want to get this done. We've got risk in our community because of this aging infrastructure, and we need to get it done. So I think you are you okay, Commissioner Samuel, with those two things that I've added in terms of adding to presentation, the 20-year look and also a communication plan?
Yep, I completely support that. And as I think about communication, as we close out the item, I would underscore two R's, risk and resilience, that what we're hearing and doing is to address real risk and that this is part of our plan to be more resilient for the long term. I think that's a message if our community understands, I think they'll understand why we think this is the right course of action.
Thank you. And Tanya, will you be able to work with staff to come up with that communication plan for us at the next meeting as part of this?
Yes, Commissioner, we'll do that.
Okay, great. Then we'll close this item. And then we have one other item that was added, 31. Are you going to take that, Mr. Paz? You're on mute, I think.
Oh, sorry. I believe property management is
okay.
This item.
That would maybe be Adrian?
Yes.
Is Adrian here?
We're bringing him over, Commissioner.
Okay, good. Hi, Adrian. Go ahead. This is item 31. Tell us what you got.
I'll try to be brief. So what you have is the agreement with the Shane Rowling Center is set to expire in May of 2021. And Dr. Shane is interested in a new agreement. Essentially what happens is you have a ground lease right now where Shane Rowling Center is responsible for the operation and maintenance of the facility. With this extension, after it sunsets, essentially you would have the city assume the rights and have the property transferred over. In the meantime, there are some capital improvements that are needed, and those are still being discussed internally with my staff. But the intent would be for us to work together with our budget department on a potential improvement or five-year life cycle plan for this facility in the event that this committee decides to move forward with this renewal, during that period of renewal so that we can, take on this facility thereafter. So again, Dr. Shane is interested in this renewal. He approached and offered to get this on, and obviously at the committee and the commission's direction, we would do a new 9-year agreement, and then the rights of this facility would revert to the city.
So just for my benefit, because I've only been here a year, can you just give us a little background when you say transfer? So who owns the property now?
So I believe that the city owns the land, and they built this building in 1988 as part of an original agreement with the JCC. Subsequent to that, they've amended the agreements to allow for capital improvements and expansion to additional boathouses, et cetera. I think Elaine Roldan from Shane Rowling Center is on. She's the executive director. She's somewhere on the call. But essentially, we have a ground lease. They built a facility. They've been operating it since then. We've renewed it, for certain periods. And now they're asking for this additional 9-year term. And after that sunsets, then the city would absorb the facility and they absorb, the obligations over capital maintenance, et cetera.
Who's doing capital maintenance now on the facility? Are we doing that?
No, they are. We have no maintenance responsibilities on this site at this time.
So all we do, we have a ground lease. That's it.
Correct.
And what's the value of the ground lease?
I don't have that information in front of me. I can certainly get that to you. And I wish I would have had it.
Maybe Raphael. Do you know the value of the lease?
In terms of what they pay, I believe that they pay a rental rate that's a nominal amount.
Yeah, that's what I was asking. I didn't know if it was commercial or if it's one of these dollar a year deal.
I believe it's one. It might be a dollar a year.
$10. It's $10. Staff just
$10. $10.
Yeah. And okay. Mr. Vice Chair, if I could answer your question in terms of the improvements. So we own the land, it's ground lease. They own the facility improvements. And the idea is that as part of this extension, that they would transfer the title to the facility improvements. Now that would put the facility on our books as a city building, and the city would then provide the property insurance. So there is a benefit to the nonprofit for the continued operation of the facility, for the city to take on that obligation as part of of our overall insurance, you know, portfolio.
So what would happen, if I understand, is they would transfer the improvement on the land, right, immediately as part of the lease, right? And then we would then take on the responsibility for liability and other insurance, right?
Correct. And that's what's proposed.
And would we also take on maintenance of the facility?
Not the day-to-day maintenance. That's still being negotiated with the Shane Rowling Center, but, you know, demise premises and, you know, basic janitorial and operation functions would still be part of the Shane Rowling Center team. So
capital improvements?
Capital improvements, the city.
Okay. And have we done an assessment of what the capital improvement needs are today?
I have done a baseline review. I've inspected the facility with my staff. You know, the roof is in need of replacement. It's beyond its useful life. It's reached its useful life. So you need a new roof. It also needs some rooftop units that are also, you know, beyond useful life. They're still holding. I mean, there's a little bit of active leaks here, there on the roof, and the units are working, but, to the tune of $900,000 is what we have unfunded right now, including a dock ramp and landing platform that's not part of the seawall project, which is already funded.
How much is the seawall project?
$780,000.
$780,000 for the seawall. That you're saying that's funded?
Yes, sir.
But we have $900,000 that would be capital improvement needs in the near term, right?
Correct. Sometime between now and the next 5 years.
Now over the next 5 years. But it sounds like the roof is more of an immediate need.
I think the dock, the platform, the 600,000 dock platform project would take priority just because it would coincide with the seawall project, which is funded, and we wouldn't want to delay. I think, you know, if I were to give a professional opinion, I think the roof would hold. There's some minor leaks here there that we could address, you know, as part of, you know, a small capital investment. But for the most part, you know, I think we'll be OK within that 5 year range if we're able to fund it.
Well, that, John, to you, funding, you got an extra $600,000.
Well, the good news here, if there is any, is that we have 5 years. Some of the money here, $600,000 isn't available today, but I imagine the seawall construction schedule probably would get us into the next capital budget cycle. Does that sound right, Adrian? In other words, the $600,000, we could probably allocate it in the upcoming FY22 capital budget, make it available October 1st. And that would probably still coincide with the construction schedule. Does that sound right?
Yes, sir. And that's part of in the memo I noted, you know, we would work with our budget department on our capital project program, and we would try to identify priorities, obviously. So, you know, I work with John and his team throughout the year, and we typically move projects and prioritize them. So this would be one that we would just, you know, add to the list, and we would go through that process. And I think we could include that in the lease language as we go through this extension, if that's the will of this committee.
And what, when is the seawall plan that's funded, the 780, when is that plan? Do we have a definitive plan?
We're still working with our public works engineering team on that. You know, I just took on this asset management function recently, so I'm, you know, trying to catch up. So I'll get a schedule and a timeline. I don't have that just yet, but I know we're still working through some of the permitting, and it did include a piece of this, a review of the dock or the floating dock.
And what's the listen, this is a great community asset, and I recognize that, but we're going to have to explain to the taxpayers we're being asked to take on an asset that's in need of substantial repairs. And that concerns me. So what's the benefit to what's the benefit of the city doing this?
As it stands today, the city would take on this facility as part of our portfolio. And whether it's this operator, this group today, or a different one tomorrow, but this would be added to our portfolio, which it isn't right now.
We own the land. We just don't own the building. I'm not sure somebody can pick up that building and move it to another piece of land so easily. So, John, what's the administration's recommendation from the financial perspective?
Well, at this point, we're committed to the seawall. So if we can't do the seawall, or if we build the seawall, but they can't operate because the dock ramp landing platform, they can't afford to pay for that, then, you know, the whole facility really isn't going to be able to operate the way it's designed to. So that's kind of where we're at, is if we do nothing, it sounds like a problem here from an operational standpoint. And this is probably the best of a rough situation.
Who's paying for the 780? Is that the city's paying for that?
I believe it is a funded project. Yes, city has this project funded.
Go ahead, Raphael. You look like you want to.
Yes, Mr. Vice Chair. I haven't been personally involved in the discussions, but I think one of the main benefits of extending the agreement and proceeding in this fashion is to preserve the current uses as a rowing center, as a rowing club, and to continue the Shane Center as it exists today. And that's the idea, to provide a public-private partnership with this nonprofit to continue the existing uses.
And are you recommending the 9-year term, or should the commission be considering a different lease term? What's the magic about the 9 years? Why is it not 5 years or 12 years?
Well, I think there is no magic, and it could be 5 years. If it's over 10 years, then this is along Indian Creek, and I believe the city attorney has opined that it would be subject to a referendum approval for a lease in excess of 10 years.
I got it. Mr. Vice Mayor, what would you like to do?
I have a couple questions. Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. And I appreciate the line of discussion. One thing I really am sort of calling for, and I know this item came a little late, is sort of the before and after, side by side. I'm just trying to get a handle on what we were doing before, what we're going to do after, how that math really plays out. First question to the city administration. Why are we doing this now? We have a lease that goes into 2021. What prompted this change, and why we're having this conversation now?
And I'm not sure if the executive director from the Shane Rowing Center is on. I know they approached us, the city asset management division to discuss potential, early renewal of this agreement. She may be on, and I see Gisela's on too from city attorney's office. They may have some background. Like I said, I'm still trying to catch up, but I understand that was the case. They approached us as interested in trying to renew, knowing that it expires in May.
Adrian, what's the name of the person from the Shane Rowing Center so we can look?
Elaine Roldan.
Okay, I see an Elaine. We'll move her over.
Elaine, are you here? Let's see, there's an attendee with their hand up. I don't know if that's somebody. Is it Bal Chima?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes. Are you with the Shane Rowing Center?
Yes. Yes, I am.
Oh, okay. Great. So the vice mayor had asked a question about what has prompted the request for their early renewal. So could you address that, please?
That started for several reasons. We had another outfit wanting to start a lease with us, Hydro, starting like November of this year. And what happened is our expires in May. So we were trying to say, why don't we just combine the approval of that lease and the renewal at the same time? That's what started it. But the second reason is also that we have a lease with University of Miami that expires prior to our lease, and they're waiting for a renewal. So there's a lot of factors that some things are happening prior to our renewal that it made more sense to get our approved so we could address the other issues.
And what is Hydro? Could you tell us what is that?
Hydro is actually a company that makes rowing similar to the Peloton for the biking. They make rowing equipment, and they wanted to lease and film upstairs. But right now, that's off the table. But I'm answering the question, what prompted the early discussions?
Okay, so that what the issue that prompted the early discussion is now off the table, it sounds.
One of them. The second one was the lease with University of Miami expires.
And when does that expire?
I think it's end of January or February, before ours. Ours is May. Theirs expires either January or February. And they're already calling us, trying to see if we've renewed so they can start their process of renewing theirs.
And you're saying they don't want to renew their lease unless they know that you have a lease facility that you can, in fact, lease services to them. Is that the reason?
That's correct. Yeah.
Commissioner Samuel, and you've got some questions. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to thank you for that, Mr. Vice Chair. Just following up in terms of the timing, I'd ask the administration and maybe the city attorney's office in terms of the urgency for an action by this body. We have a meeting in about 3 weeks, I think, and it sounds like some things are still, you know, being reviewed and contemplated. I certainly want to see the numbers laid out. We got this about 24 hours ago. So question to the administration, how urgent is action on this at this moment in time?
We're still in the process of putting together a lease agreement, so it's not exactly urgent. We just didn't want to miss the opportunity to discuss it at this committee. To Bao's point, I know they're in the process of renewing with the University of Miami, but we wanted to discuss it, see what, you know, just have that fruitful discussion and get, you know, your feedback, and then go back, review the agreement with the Shane Rowing Center and start those negotiations. And then come back to, you'll see it, you know, at the commission either in the next, you know, few months.
Okay. I honestly, Mr. Vice Chair, my preference, if it fits into the schedule, because the Shane Rowing Center has been a good community partner, we don't want to, you know, have a gap. But if we're looking for a recommendation out of finance, I frankly would like to hear the status of those negotiations, the updates on the numbers, maybe even back to our November meeting. That to me would be helpful to see it just so we have a little more. If this was a discussion item, I think we've had the discussion, but if we're looking for a recommendation, I think we probably would want one more review of it.
Thank you, Vice Mayor. And I think you and I are rowing at the same pace today. So I totally agree with you. Let's continue this. Let's bring it back on November 13th. We'll have a little bit more information. Two things that I would need, and maybe Commissioner Samuel would like some other things, but I want an additional discussion about the lease terms. I am not today inclined to give a 9-year lease on assets that we're being asked to take over that need significant capital improvements. Having said that, I recognize this is a very important asset for the city of Miami Beach because of the opportunity to continue the activities that have been going there, which are incredibly important for us. The other thing that I would like to see, given that there's a discussion of moving the asset to the city books, and we are going to have to come up with the capital improvements. I don't know if we have looked at the financial statements of the Shane Rowing, but one thing that I will not be interested in doing is if Shane Rowing as an entity is making substantial revenues, if you will, they need to be a partner in some of these improvements. Now, if they are not, then I can understand why the city is going to step up and help. But the budget guy has got alerts going up about the transfer of the asset at a time when there is a need for substantial capital improvements. And that's sending alerts flying around my head right now. So I would like to understand the financials of the Shane that would cause the need to transfer assets needing substantial capital improvements. Having said that, I think it's great to have this in our portfolio. I just want to make sure it's going to be good for the taxpayer. So with that, if it's okay with you, Commissioner Samuelin, we're going to continue this until November 13th. And we're going to ask the administration to come back with more details, and we will take another bite at this apple at that time. Is that okay?
Agreed.
Okay. We'll continue that item until November 13th. John, I don't see any other items on the agenda. Have I got everything?
Got it. Thank you.
Okay. Having completed the agenda, everyone have a wonderful day, and the meeting's adjourned. Thanks so much.
Thank you, everyone.
Take care. Thank you.